I'm gonna undo my
okay,
my belt and my top button. Sure. I do this in cinema.
Fine.
I do this in cinemas because I've got quite a small bladder, and but then it's fine for, because obviously you're in the dark, no one gives a shit. I mean, you know, the 1 second that someone looks at you and you're fiddling around with your button, people are like, okay. Especially if you're with some, well, actually, is it? Especially if you're with someone.
No,
else.
If you're alone, it's way worse.
Okay, fair enough. And then whenever I stand up at the end of a film, like I watched Tar recently.
Right, I really want to see it. Is
oh,
it good?
It's incredible.
Yeah, okay.
Right up until the point where I stand up at the very end, I'm like fiddling around with my belt. The person I was with was like, the lights are up now. I went, well, what else am I going to do? Just walk out like...
Yeah, with it just hanging around.
Welcome to Magic the Flavoring, a Magic the Gathering podcast, where we talk about all things magic, flavor design, and lore. I'm your host, Andy Bam.
Hello, this is Nathan Cancy.
And we're in for a big boy episode today.
Oh, yes. It's a chonky one.
It's a chonky, chonky boy. We're going to do... we sound like radio hosts there.
That's
it's a chonky boy.
What is a podcast if it isn't a scripted, like... Okay, yeah, we don't have the little button press... going out this Wednesday, you know, but I mean, like, you know, what's the difference really beyond a potential half-hearted script?
Yeah,
you know?
We are doing all 10 episodes of Phyrexia All Will Be One.
So, funnily enough, I got through, like, I got to a week, and I think you noticed this when I started speaking to you last week, like, the two, because we've known about all of the names for so long,
yeah.
Genuinely... In my mind, March of the Machine is kind of what this set is like, right? Because
yeah.
it's their marching into the multiverse, and then All Will Be One feels more like a culmination. So the fact that it's All Will Be One is this set, and March of the Machine is actually the next set.
But All Will Be One is this set,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, All Will Be One is this set, even though, whatever. Regardless of actual perceived semantics, beyond perceived semantics, this set is All Will Be One, even though I feel like the two names should have been the other way around.
Yeah.
But whatever.
Cool.
It's fine.
First critique. All right, we're doing all 10 episodes. We're doing the 5 main stories and the 5 side stories. And, I mean, can I call this a golden age of magic writing? Are we allowed to say that now, or are we still hurting from War of the Spark era collectively?
It's better. We've come back. I like to say we've come back to the kind of storytelling that we deserve.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I took a drink. That sounds like the kind that we deserve. Well, now that begs the question: what do we deserve?
This. I thought like this is at a base rate, because I mean, it's still not without fault and without critique and without some question marks. And I think from a stylistic and delivery point of view, I think it's doing well. I think from what the actual content is, you can pick apart some decisions, some, like, you know, descriptives, that kind of thing, like, that, you know, might be questionable, but, you know, the things that Reddit loves to, like, call out. But I think in terms of how the story is being delivered, we're coming towards that same part we did with War of the Spark before it all got fucked up by all these novels, of being like, good, we've got a steady pace, we seem to have a good projection, everyone's kind of caught up with everything, it's being delivered in a pace I feel like is acceptable. They're showing good sides to characters. I feel like we're not getting like misrepresentations. There's not just throwaway lines every now and again. Like, yeah, I don't know, it feels more, oh, do I say the word, it feels more complete. I'm sorry.
All right, then. We're going to do it all in one episode.
Yeah.
We have split these down in the past, but we thought, screw it, we're going to go for it. And there's a lot going on here. And a lot of, like, we'll go into, obviously, each story individually. Well, for the side stories, we definitely will. But the authors that they've brought back for some of these are pretty impressive. It has been like a who's who of, like, recent magic story. Yeah. And it's actually really interesting to see them back to back, but we will get to the side stories. The main stories are headed up by Shauna Maguire, also known, and this is me reading from the bio on the mothership, also known as Mira Grant and A. Deborah Baker. Shauna Maguire is an award-winning author of short stories, novels, comics. She lives in the Pacific Northwest with far too many cats and skeletons. And we know Shauna Maguire in terms of magic stories, because they're the ones who penned Tangles, Dance of Undeath, and Homecoming. Tangles obviously being one that we really loved and did an actual episode dedicated to on its own. I mean, just, I'm going to do a very brief overview, and this one genuinely will be brief, but, I mean, how are we feeling about Shauna Maguire in general?
Oh, phenomenal. I mean, I like that they've clearly seen someone who can handle different, like, character, like character-led stories, being like Tangles, for example, showing a really good example of how we see both Ren and we see Teferi, their perspectives, how they interact with each other. And this is one of the stories we lauded because it was really interesting seeing these two very different Planeswalkers interacting. And we've kind of had these like Saturday morning TV show kind of versions of Planeswalkers and their voices and the way that, you know, decidedly male kind of, you know, we've had lines like that before where it kind of undermines the character of a lot of the Planeswalkers and people we've seen over the course of years. So, so the fact they've been given them a cast of, maybe, what, 12-ish? Like, if we don't consider non-Planeswalker characters.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's kind of good to see them do a couple of things. Like, also Homecoming was a really good example of seeing Liliana Vess's voice kind of with the Raven Man and how the two of them kind of interacted.
Mm.
I mean, if there is someone out there who's doing this kind of like, okay, what's the best way of representing this story? They've really looked at people that know how to speak effectively, because there's a lot of talking in these. There's a lot of dialogue between characters.
Dialogue, yeah.
We're not looking at, remind me of the Zendikar Rising author, the guy who did all of the, when we went to Back to Zendikar.
Yes.
Really, really good environmental description.
Miguel Lopez?
Yes, Miguel Lopez. Thank you.
I've got to look that up.
So it is. I say this confidently because you sparked a memory in my brain. But so he's really good at like descriptive and like location-based narrative, whereas clearly Seanan's shown like a penchant, or penchant, however you want to pronounce it.
Penchant.
Yeah, I don't... Right, so this is one thing. I'm going to make an aside. For years, I was under the impression this was a French word and you're supposed to pronounce it penchant, and everyone I ever see it saying it ever is always penchant. And so in my mind, it niggles me and it icks me because I'm pretty sure it's penchant, but apparently it's not. It's penchant, and I don't know. Anyway, they've clearly got a good voice for voices, and this, of all stories, really needed that, so I think it was a really good selection.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. It's we do have Miguel Lopez coming back to do one of the side stories, and I think that really sort of shines through. I can't find it.
I'm almost 100% sure it is.
Oh no, you're gonna hate me.
Mm.
It's AC Greenblatt.
Fuck.
It's alright, but no.
Was it all the side stories?
Miguel Lopez did the Brothers War.
Did he not do the side story? The one where they're flying with Akiri, the Akiri side story.
Oh, they did. The Mugosi Steps.
Yeah.
Oh, well, there
that's
you go.
What I meant. There we go. Ah, good. Fantastic. Right. Because that's the bit I remember is when
Akiri's... and the red route and the Mugosi
Steps.
Yeah.
So when when they're drifting through the sky clays, that was the bit I remember being like, man, this is really intense, like chunky writing that I know a lot of people maybe find a bit more annoying to grok, but it allows me to sink into a story when I can feel the flow of the writing really describing the environment. And as much as we went through 9 spheres within this story, arguably we skipped a couple of them or whatever, but as much as the environment's important, the dialogue between the characters is actually probably the most important here, where you're trying to balance all of these different voices from different planes, all having different perspectives and understandings and different, what's the word, like hierarchies, almost, like who's the most important person in a conversation. You know, is it Jace, is it Kaya, is it Nahiri? Like, that's quite difficult to balance, and I feel like for the most part it was done very well.
Yeah, very good memory. Cool. All right, let's do the little blow-by-blow of the main storylines. I tried to keep this to 2 sentences per one, because we've got a lot to get through, and presumably you have read, dear listener, these stories before listening to this episode, or at least the main story ones. So, just as a prelude to this, so I don't have to do exposition in my explanation, so I'll do a prelude, which is the same amount of time anyway. This is the Planeswalker Task Force that we saw at the end of the side stories of the Brothers War, going to New Phyrexia to use the Silex made by Saheeli to blow up New Phyrexia before the invasion starts, an invasion they know is coming. And they have a rough idea of things like the Realmbreaker Tree, and this is literally the party planeswalking into New Phyrexia. So, episode 1 opens up with the Planeswalker Task Force, who are scattered immediately by some sort of Phyrexian failsafe on entering the plane. So there's some kind of magical force field. They never really flesh it out, but the party of Planeswalkers is scattered across the plane. And these stories focus on Kaito, Kaya, Nahiri, and Tyvar, with the Wanderer also there, but the Wanderer's spark is now playing up again and is kind of phasing her in and out of the plane. These Planeswalkers find themselves on the beaches of New Phyrexia, whilst their comrades are spread across everywhere else. They meet up with a Mirren resistance cell led by a healer called Malira, who is resistant to the Phyrexian oil and Phyresis and also can heal others. And that becomes quite important throughout the story as to when she does and doesn't use that power. And the first story focuses on them meeting up and going to the furnace layer of New Phyrexia to meet up with another Mirren cell. Episode 2, we have Elspeth and Jace join the party, and Koth is still alive.
Hype,
and Elspeth and Koth have their moment of sort of seeing each other from the previous Phyrexian and Mirrodin arcs, which is all very nice and heartwarming. And the Planeswalker party with the Mirren resistance cell plan a sort of path to go deeper into the layers of New Phyrexia to try and complete their mission. We have a lot of really cool back and forths with Jace and the other Planeswalkers, not really sure how much they want to give the Mirrens in terms of, you know, this Silex might destroy New Phyrexia and therefore Mirrodin, and they don't know whether they can trust the Mirrens with this information because they still want them to help them. And then we see a lot of, like, you know, what I loved about these stories, to kind of immediately dive into critique in the middle of my explanation, is that a lot of these stories did a really good job of showing how regular non-Planeswalky people are sometimes more, like, willing to sacrifice, like, the boundaries of the multiverse than the Planeswalkers are, which is kind of interesting. In episode 3, the party travels to the Dross Pits lair, which is the black-aligned sort of Sheldrin and the rest of the Thanes. It's their lair. And we discover that Vraska is in a Phyrexian arena, being attacked by a bunch of Phyrexians, and that she is also tainted by Phyrexia herself. Jace is psychically linked to her. He was meant to be linked to all of them, but the Phyrexian barrier knocked that out. Nahiri at this point has also been tagged by Phyrexians. She was tagged in the first story, but her kind of completion hasn't come fully round, whereas Vraska's like 80% there by the time they get to her. Jace, because he loves Vraska, obviously, tries to save her, putting the rest in danger, the rest of their party. The rest of the party do eventually escape, and Vraska succumbing to Phyrexia is given one last mercy by Jace, showing them a life they could have had on Ravnica in an illusion. The illusion is ended. When now a fully completed Vraska, I shouldn't laugh really, attacks Jace, and, well, not even attacks, sort of surreptitiously stabs him.
Stabby stabby.
Spikes him with Phyrexian oil because,
poke,
you know,
poke.
It's really heartbreaking. Yeah, I know we're making light of it. Yeah, it's really terrible. That's episode 3. So Jace is now got the glistening oil coursing through his veins. He rejoins the rest of the party, knowing that Vraska is kind of beyond saving, because he's the only one in his mind that can sort of detonate the Silex. And now they have an injured Jace, no Vraska, a Phyrexianized, soon-to-be Nahiri, and a whole bunch of other shit going on. Nahiri, at the end of that story, uses her lithomancy to blast a hole through the ground of the Dross Pit into the kind of sky, the ceiling of the porcelain. What's it called?
Is it not the Great Basilica?
Oh my gosh.
Fair Basilica.
Fair Basilica, there
Fair
we go.
Fair Basilica.
Which also allows a bunch of black-aligned Phyrexians to start pouring into the white-aligned sphere and basically stoking the fires of the Civil War that Urabrask and Sheldred and the Thanes, and basically all of the non-Elish Norn Praetors are all like gagging for this kind of big Civil War that's kind of spilling over. So now we have the Planeswalkers in the Fair Basilica. Nahiri's nowhere to be found because they assume that she's been caught under the rubble. And they carry on with their plan. In episode 4, the remaining team start to work their way to the heart of Elish Norn's domain with the Silex, and discover the Realmbreaker tree is ready to start the invasion. Tyvar kind of loses his nut over this because obviously it's a bastardization of the World Tree from his home plane of Kaldheim. Jace's completion is sort of constantly threatening to take hold, and by this point he really should have been turned, but by sheer force of will he's kind of carrying on. Malira, as we were sort of saying earlier, is a healer, but with all of the Planeswalkers that have been tagged so far, they're not in a position where they can rest and stop. Like, this whole 5 episodes is just one mad dash from the surface down. Mm-hmm. They barely have time to catch their breath, let alone heal from Phyresis. So there's lots of her and the other Planeswalkers who are being tagged going, well, I could be healed, or we could complete the mission. Yeah. So there's lots of sort of self-sacrifice going on. Along the way, Tybalt and Ajani, now fully completed, arrive, and Tyvar and Elspeth respectively face their foes. So we get to see the culmination of Tybalt's Vorinclex seed.
Yeah, his seeded by Vorinclex.
Seeded by Vorinclex, which
never
was,
sounds any better.
It was one line in Kaldheim that everyone, well, not even everyone, I think we even commented on this, how many people just kind of glossed over it.
Yeah.
But it was noticed where everyone went, Tybalt's got a Phyrexian seed, and then it's just never mentioned again.
Yeah, we haven't seen him since.
And now he's back, and he's all Phyrexianized and looking
more
devilish.
Doesn't even get a card.
Does he not? He's on a couple of cards.
He's on a card. Well, he's in a couple of artworks. Well, there was a very telling artwork, right, that was kind of shown of Tyvar, kind of like, you know, what's it called? What was it? Undertaker's move? The choke slam. That's
yeah, yeah, he's got exactly. a choke slam. And then Ajani has come back and he's like fully porcelain armoured and fully Elesh Norned up.
Looks fucking sick.
Yeah, the artwork is pretty damn good. It's worth him dying just to get that kind of look for him, I think.
It's worth him dying anyway, boring fuck.
Who cares about Ajani? Wow. Tyvar and Elsbeth fight up against their foes. Excuse me, I'm so sorry. The Mirrens, by the remaining Planeswalkers in Episode 5, time to get to the centre of the World Tree, or the Realm Breakers, they're calling it. Kaito, Jace, and Kaya at this point, so they can detonate the Silex. But Kaya and Kaito, at the pivotal moment when they should just blow up the Silex, start to understand that if the Realmbreaker tree is connected already to the rest of the planes and it's just the physical invasion that's yet to start, if the Silex goes off, could that blast not go beyond even... They thought it could just be the core of New Phyrexia, and then they're like, well, it could be the whole plane. Well, if it could be the whole plane, can it not extend into the multiverse and even maybe the actual blind eternities themselves? So they have a sort of crisis of conscience whether they think what they're going to do is right. They face off against Jace, and Jace being convicted in his plan to detonate the Silex and seconds away from turning to Phyrexia, starts the process to blow up the Silex. Just as Kaya and Kaito fail to stop Jace in his mission, Elsbeth and Tyvar burst through out of nowhere, seemingly having defeated Tybalt and Ajani, because we kind of left those battles... we saw Tybalt get killed, but Ajani-Elsbeth battle we left on a cliffhanger. And Elsbeth swoops in with the detonating Silex, and planeswalks away. We know not where. We don't even know if she gets to another plane. It could just be in the Blind Eternities themselves and basically absorbs... Well, it is presumed, because we don't see the body. It is presumed that she absorbs the Silex blast where it can't detonate anywhere else. They don't have a traditional prologue like a lot of these things are, but the last scene that we see are the remaining defeated planeswalkers basically being routed by Elesh Norn, a now fully Phyrexianized Jace with a halo sword, Luxor, buried in his chest, much echoing the kind of alternate reality artwork that we saw, which was a nice little nod, the What If artwork. He's now fully gone. We have Tamio showing up against Elesh Norn's side, and now also Nyssa, who in these main five stories we didn't see at all, and has now turned up fully Phyrexianized.
That's true. Yeah, if you don't read any of the side stories, Nyssa showing up is just a kind of like... Hello!
Yeah, like, what the
fuck? And Elesh is like, look who I made besties, and it's Neri and Nyssa like looking at each other like, yes, Queen Slay.
Yeah. Oh, also the Phyrexian invasion starts.
Oh, yeah, and then there's that moment where she's like, we'll be one, and she's like, what's the line? With that, Elesh Norn raised her hand, clicking her perfect claws together, and the invasion began.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. So... Like we were saying this before we started recording, and I think I mentioned it there. It is five episodes, but it really is just one mad dash.
Yeah.
Like from start to finish, it's like boom, we're in the plane. We need to get from here to here. It's like a reverse. Was it Judge Dredd and The Raid? All those films where they have to get from floor 1 to floor 75.
Yeah, it's the other way around. It's the other way around. Instead of an ascent.
Yeah, yeah. They've got like a descent all the way down to the bottom. We know what the plan is. And actually, I think what I really liked about, and I think was maybe a kindness for Shauna Maguire, is that they got given a set of stories that they could just focus on one goal, because a lot of the setup got... given to other writers. Mm. So I think there was a lot of legwork done to make this story slick. We don't need to know what the plan is. I mean, obviously they do reiterate it during the course of the stories because they're debating as to what the right course of action is, but if you've been keeping up with the story, mm-hmm. and this section, some story arcs you can kind of jump into and if you're new to magic. This isn't one of them, I don't think. But that's a good thing, because we just want to see the story moving forwards now. We have had a couple of sets, if you count Brothers War and even Dominaria United, that, yes, have a lot of exposition, but we've known this has been coming for a while.
Yeah. As an audience, you're like, but the invasion.
Yeah.
And there are still, I think there are two parts of this that I think still kind of a massive, bugbears for me in terms of, as a whole. And this is this continues to end up getting into like a little debate on Reddit, as you always do, as any purveyor of Reddit, you end up debating with everyone about everything. But one of the things I was saying was like that it's annoying that you don't get a week, just once a week, kind of updates on story. Because what you could have done is you could have had a weekly episode that kind of shows them making the plan together. Because I feel like there was two things missing from this, and there was one that was when everything started going to shit, it kind of showed immediately like they didn't have a contingency, and we didn't see what discussions they had for what they were planning to happen, of what they, like, you know, again having some fail safes if this didn't happen, if this didn't happen. It kind of got, they got really, really, really lucky that the amount that their plan failed wasn't greater, because then being scattered randomly across throughout the nine spheres to have to then meet up together, like it I don't understand how they even managed to put the plan back together as a semblance of the former plan, you know, like they got lucky. Elspeth even said in the first episode, you know, when they initially impacted and they hit that top layer, the what is it, the facade, whatever the top layer is called, the glorious facade, the monumental facade, the sand there almost like puts you in a stupor of where it's not an active threat, but it pacifies you to the point of where the other Phyrexians then come and kill you. And like even Elspeth said, like, oh, it's a good thing it didn't arrive sooner. I'm like, don't point out the narrative flaws. Like, don't they have your characters kind of go like, hey, this is a lucky thing that didn't happen. Because then it just kind of shows the audience like, well, yeah, but that is a very lucky thing that happened. Like,
interesting. I don't know. I think there was so much work done in these stories and in the side stories to show just how fucking dangerous New Phyrexia is. The air can kill you. The sand isn't sand. It's just bits of metal. And all the metal is also Phyrexianized. You know, so you're basically breathing in all the phyresis. The dross pits are full of toxic gas that can do it. The fucking air, like the sort of your vision around you can trick you into thinking you're somewhere else. Like that whole sequence where Kaito, because it's from his perspective in the first episode, thinks that New Phyrexia looks beautiful because to his,
it's convincing.
It's convincing him, and also, but like to, you know, his kind of confused mind, the kind of crashing. There's like crashing of the waves, and he sort of sees birds up ahead, and he feels the beach. And obviously, when he comes to a bit more, he realizes these are all bastardizations and Phyrexianized versions of what he's seeing. But it's, you know, it's showing you that the edge between thinking that Phyrexia is this wonderful thing as like a philosophy versus it being the horror that you can sort of see. Like we've had touches of it with planeswalkers like Ajani and Tamiyo still speaking as themselves, just with a bent of going
with the voice of
Phyrexia. Tamiyo still talks about family. Ajani still talks about pride. Yeah. They're just doing it for a different
being
thing.
Unity.
Unified.
Yeah, exactly.
So I do think that everything's so lucky and they could have fallen at any time, and you know, stop pointing it out because it makes it seem like they're just kind of falling with style. I sort of feel like that's true, and that's the point.
Yeah, I guess it does demonstrate very clearly like how damned the entire thing is from the get-go. I guess also it does follow suit that we kind of felt like it was a little rushed towards the end of the last story arc, of where we're like, Rebrask is like, well, his resistance and his is happening in the next, like, it's happening tomorrow, we haven't got any time to plan. So it kind of does, like, if you read these back to back, it does have this kind of feeling of, we have no time to plan, this is happening tomorrow, we need to do it now. And then the story starts and they're already kind of hitting a plane and everything goes to disarray immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
It also kind of does do this thing of propping, if you weren't already aware of how much of a threat Phyrexia is, and if we did have, again, that underlying criticism of where was this slow impending doom?
Yeah, Dominaria United was very rushed.
There were a couple of like points across the last few years of where we kind of felt it didn't have, in the same way that people complained that the Nicol Bolas arc took too long to happen, even though it had all these nice little pieces that all joined together, you know, with the Immortal Sun and all that kind of thing, like, that took too long, it was too plinky-plonky, whereas this kind of felt like it condensed it, but it kind of created, this perspective of there's nothing you can do, everything is terrible, and it's only going to get worse the further you descend. If anything, I guess I just wanted more, like, immediate loss, because it would have given a greater credence, like, the threat's proven, but then actually within the first, like, few stories, and also they release these across a week. This didn't happen week on week for a month and a half like it would have happened in the past. This all happened across the span of, like, 10 days. And once the planeswalkers started dropping, it was every story. One was dropping and one was dropping. Like,
yeah,
the fact that Nahiri, and it's mentioned in that first story, and this is one thing that I think is really, really good, is they showed, like, power levels and power disparity really well in these stories, of where Nahiri's lauded by the other walkers of being like, wow, all these things she's doing, she's barely even breaking a sweat. She is one of the oldest, if not the oldest walkers around us. Like, she's got the strongest amount of power. To the point of where she says, I don't want you to heal me, Melira, because Melira notices and says to her, like, oh, you had the look of someone who was still convincing themselves they could still be okay, kind of thing. So trying to hide the fact that they'd been tainted. Mm. And Nahiri goes, there's not enough time. Like, you need me so badly that we need to just continue. There's not enough time for me to take 3 days recovering, and if you try and kill me now, you will not succeed. Yeah. So let's just carry on with the plan, because that's the best chance of success.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they did a really good job of that. And also to... I mean, you know, there was a whole debate when they were sort of showing, look, these are the planeswalkers that are going to be in this story arc, in this kind of section of the story. 10 of them, 5 of them are going to fall. Mm. Like, you know, oh, you were upset about Ajani, oh, you're upset about Tamiyo.
Yeah.
Well, 5 of these
don't hold
are
on
go.
To any of, yeah, any yeah, of your yeah. loves, yeah, because they're all going to fucking
and
fall.
And it can be any of them. Mm. Like, and people were trying to think of theories, were like, well, they're not going to get rid of Jace because he's the poster boy, or they're not going to get rid of Vraska, or like, blah, 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 or like, you know, whatever the things were. But they didn't count on the idea of just looking at who. I mean, I'm sure someone did, because they're like, with an infinite amount of typewriters and infinite amount of monkeys, we're all going to write the correct answer. But I very rarely saw people looking at things like, well, Mirrodin is a plane of metal and like ore. Mm. Out of the planeswalkers that are going on this task force, who is the most powerful in that setting? Well, it's Nahiri.
Yeah.
So who's going to be the most likely one that they're going to bump off to not just make them go, and Nahiri exploded the plane, because she could fucking do that.
That's the
and
thing,
it's like,
right?
Well, of course
yeah.
they're going to get her right, Phyrexian eyes. Like, she blew a hole through a layer, like, with like it was nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and so they have to get rid of her in the story. So yeah. it's really cool that they did that.
Yeah, I think that it's a shame that she obviously tried to do this as an act of, like, self-sacrifice. I think she dropped the entire Phyrexian arena. Because that's what it is. It's a real rebuild. We've seen this in the Commander Collection Black set of where it was a Shieldred version of the Phyrexian arena, and it's also confirmed to be the same arena that Koth's fighting in the Phyrexian arena that we got from a few years back, where people were like, oh shit, Koth's still alive. It's like, yeah, and they even mentioned, he was like, oh, I barely escaped the last time I was within the arena. And obviously the Vraska, we don't actually know what I like to call the timeline of fate of a couple of the walkers, in terms of, like, we know that Nyssa arrived with Jace, and then some trap caused her to planeswalk away further. Yeah. Now, what that to me, which isn't said, which will bring me around in a second to point number two of things that were missing from this that I think really should have been in there. So I imagine there was a trap or something that forced her to move to a different place, because they want to complete Nyssa, because Nyssa's really, really important in pushing the Realmbreaker and pushing it into the other planes. I think that need of, like, ley line manipulation,
yeah,
I think that's what they wanted Nyssa for from the get-go.
Yeah.
And I think there's a reason why they honed in on her, and why she's the only one apart from the Wanderer who blipped once they'd already landed, because they must have held onto a spark or identified her or scanned her or whatever and gone, we need her, let's take her down and convert her. Apart from that, Vraska's the only one we don't know, like, when she arrived. We don't get a point of view of her. All we get is when Elspeth starts passing around these vials of Halo, which apparently, you know, Luxior can generate more Halo. Jace kind of gets this almost, like, reboot to his system, and it's like a resurgence, and he can then reconnect to everyone, immediately feels Vraska's pain, immediately reconnects, and immediately reminds all of the audience of why we were shipping them so hard by the end of Ixalan, because their connection, we haven't seen the two of them together properly since War of the Spark, and even that was pretty ham-fisted by the end of it. Oh, we'll agree to stay apart for the safety of each other. Shut up, none of the fans want that. You're in love. You fucking love each other. Of course you do. He's willing to damn the rest of the multiverse for his love for Vraska. That's actually way more related than having them, you know, be like platonic or whatever. So that was one of the ones that was interesting. We didn't get to see when Vraska first arrived and then the process, but it is mentioned again that the Necrogen air naturally starts to convert you. So as soon, I think it's in a flavor text on one of the cards as well, like, the taint happened immediately for Vraska. As soon as she was split down to the Dross levels, there was no hope for her.
Yeah.
Because it was automatically going to start the process, because she didn't have the access to Halo that Elspeth did. Whether they should have all done a bit of Halo before descending into New Phyrexia?
Yeah, this is something, the Halo thing specifically, just to touch on that, because it was only touched on, really, in the story. So we had a whole arc of Elspeth on New Capenna, and a whole thing about this substance, and obviously it being the kind of magical MacGuffin of New Capenna, like the ether in Kaladesh or whatever. This idea of Halo, this substance that could be consumed, that a lot of things are sort of, like, surreptitiously made out of, that the angels, like, bestowed on, and then you have Giada, who's an angel who can produce more, and she's the fountain, and all this kind of stuff. The whole story was based on that. And I know, obviously, stories just need to have some sort of crux to make the characters move about. But it did sort of seem like Halo was going to be like this fucking weapon against mm-hmm. Phyrexia. And then this story arc, they down a couple of vials as a tincture to kind of ward off the phyresis of the Dross Pits. They said it wasn't going to work too well. It keeps Jace about for a little bit longer. And then even when Elsbeth fucking stabs Jace through the chest with the sword, with the Halo in the hilt...
Nothing happens.
Nothing really happens. Now, obviously, we don't know what's going on further.
Mm.
And I know that in the Brothers War side stories, the sword was pretty badass in the battle.
Yeah.
So it has done something. But you know when you're just like, that was like a whole, like, fuck, Elsbeth's found this thing.
It was almost like that was the whole point of that entire set was...
getting Halo.
Urabrask was mounting a resistance and we need to get the Halo to maybe... And I guess we don't... Pardon me. We don't know what the Halo's going to be doing in the future. The Halo might be the point that helps return some of the less Phyrexianized walkers back to being, you know, their normal selves, or at least, you know, like, neutralize the Phyrexian spread. You know, there are some that I don't think will come back, like a Jarni, for example. I think now with Cinnamon his new armor, I think it's probably pretty obvious that we can't go back. Say maybe with Vraska, because now she's got a full Gorgon tail going on. And I
yeah,
don't know
that's
if,
interesting. We'll talk about that.
I don't know if there are legs under there or not. So I think there might be a point. And the fact that Elspeth herself, to skip to the end and kind of like start theory crafting what's happening with the end of the story, like the fact that she jettisoned herself into the Blind Eternities with a detonating Silex, with all these question marks over her whether or not she is actually an angel or not an angel, and like there are so many like kind of question marks around it that make me feel like this isn't the end of Halo. It's almost like a... It was almost like a false failure, you know. Like it did enough to keep Jace around to kind of fulfill his role within the story. Mm. It didn't exactly act as like the this can stop things right now, because the whole point of this set was the Phyrexians need to succeed, no matter what the Planeswalkers do, no matter how good their plan was. Which I guess undermines my we should have had a better plan. They should have had more contingency. From a narrative point of view, this set needed the Planeswalkers to fail. They needed to have at least five of them, you know, get completed by the end of it, and they needed to feel like by the end of by the end of the five episodes, the way back was nigh on impossible.
Mm,
you know, and there needed to be a grandiose, you know, extra trump from the good side to be able to then take to kind of bring us back to either a neutrality or to defeat the Phyrexians 100%, you know. Mm. So it's understandable. There was also kind of like, it felt a little bit undermining to the Halo that a couple of episodes beforehand, we get the Hex Gold.
Yeah.
Which is another MacGuffin. I mean, Magic is a game of MacGuffins, let's be honest. It's setting up yeah. ridiculous fantasy villains, ridiculous fantasy adversaries, and the only way to do this is to have your, you know, good guy MacGuffins that, you know, magically save the day and fix things. So the Hex Gold, I guess, was kind of like, I expected Halo to be a step up from that, but Halo kind of just felt like a similar sidestep of like, oh, we've got the Hex Gold for your armor,
yeah.
and then we've also got the Halo to protect you.
I think the Hex Gold was a nice way to have Tyvar involved, because they obviously had a set of Planeswalkers where they're either planning to do stuff with them in the future, so they want them to kind of be the new crop, or they have, like, fan favourites.
Kaito Wanderer, for example.
Kaito Wanderer, yeah. yeah. I mean, Tyvar, interestingly, out of the Kaldheim stories, he could have very easily just been, like, the Planeswalker of the set, do you know what I mean? Like, the new guy. And then, because, I mean, my, you know, my wifey, Arlene Cord, as much as she's come back in Innistrad sets, she hasn't really been anywhere else, you know, except for World Spark. Whereas Tyvar was a bit of a breakout star.
Yeah.
I mean, infinitely fancy.
Everyone loves
sexy.
His shirtiness.
Well, yeah, he's, yeah, and he's also sexy as shit in this set of stories. But it was a way to have him be involved because he transmutes. Aside from being just buff and heroic and swashbuckly with a sword and all that kind of shit, his magic, his mage power, is that he transmutes material.
Yeah.
So it was
actually quite useful.
Really useful
setting.
On a plane of metal.
Yeah.
And I think like Nahiri could have been OP, but if they gave him a really specific. His thing is the Hex Gold.
That's true. He is kind of like Nahiri Light. Like, the same thing, if you look at, like, Nahiri, Koth, and Tyvar, they all kind of do a similar aspect
they,
of things.
Yeah, they even mention it in the story.
Yeah, one's stone, one's meta. I think the mention is that, I think Kai was like saying, like, oh, you know, because Koth's a geomancer and Nahiri's a lithomancer,
it's,
don't ask me what the difference
is. It's Malira.
Is.
Malira says
that's it.
That's
it, yeah, exactly. So there is even a point of, like, okay, so what is the... And I even thought this halfway through the stories with Kaito. I was like, shit, I don't even remember what Kaito's ability actually is. Oh, he's got like some degree of telepathy.
Yeah, telekinetic.
Right, yeah. Which works because, again, not being able to touch the metal, but being able to control the metal, really important in a world where the metal immediately can corrupt you.
Yeah.
So I think like there was a degree of like, why the fuck are all of these people here kind of thing. And, you know, we'll get around to Luca and whether or not he's the only one who's maybe still got a question mark behind him. But I think a lot of people expected either one or the other of the Wanderer or Kaito to get completed, because it then creates a greater incentive, narrative incentive, for the other one to want to fight. But both of them ended up kind of getting out of it in the right way. I think one of the greatest things about this set is the Kaito Taiva bromance, and so many people are on board with this. This is really interesting. Again, two characters I think individually, outside of their plane, we don't know what they're like. We've seen them on their plane, and for both of them, like, you're like, okay, they're both just like, you know, like dude-y kind of fanboys, you know? Kaito just really, really, really simps on the Wanderer. Fair enough. So do a lot of people. And then everyone simps on Taiva, because who can blame the muscles?
Yeah.
So, but the two of them together actually created this kind of bromance where it's like, I've only known this bromance has existed for five minutes, but I will kill everybody in this room and myself if it was to break up again.
Yeah, like they got paired off. I mean, what I really liked about Taivar's characterization in general is that he is so from Kaldheim. Like, the other
players... I am so from Kaldheim.
But like, in terms of, so I don't, this might be like real magic wankiness, but this is what this exact podcast is for. If you look at other planeswalkers specifically in terms of where they're from as a home plane and how they behave, a lot of them, it has to be said, can be very interchangeable.
You very much so, yeah.
Just because it'd be impossible to have like someone from fucking Tovalar or Amonkhet just, you know, be so tuned into that.
Did you say Tovalar, I mean Innistrad.
Oh, Tovalar is from Innistrad.
Tovalar is the plane.
He is a character from Innistrad, and he's a werewolf and not a planeswalker. Okay, I secede from the podcast. I'm not doing I have no idea.
You could be
I'm
from Tovalar. There might be a plane of Tovalar out there. It's an infinite multiverse. It's fine.
There is a plane which is similar. I'm not getting into it anyway. So, but like, do you know what I mean? Like, it'd be hard to put them in any other story because blah blah blah. Mm. Where if you look at Taivar, who comes from a plane where it's a very diverse plane in terms of race, because they've got 10 realms each with their own sort of racial structures. It's a very diverse plane in terms of, like, the abilities of those people and how they conduct themselves. Mm. But the one unifying thing, and we said this in our episodes, and it was a really big line through, is it's about the story of heroism and about the strength of your heart and character in those stories. It's like, morality is kind of grey. We forget that Taivar is black aligned. He's green and black aligned. So, like, morality is kind of a fluid thing. But it's about being, like, swashbuckly and having that kind of ha-ha aspect. And so to have Taivar being in this situation and being on board with the plan or disagreeing with characters or whatever else, like, he's met this completely alien planeswalker, a plane that couldn't be more different than his own, Kamigawa. And the Kamigawa in Neon Kamigawa territory, right? He's a ninja rather than a straight-up warrior, which, you know, could be a thing. He's a completely different physical build, the whole shebang. Mm. Completely different, and yet he knows Kaito has, like, a sense of, like, strength and is, duty, like, a warrior, well, and is also himself a bit of a swashbuckler. Kaito's not a dry character.
No, not
and he instantly gravitates towards him, and he instantly calls everyone else friend if they're on his side, and he's just so, like, just everything about
him.
Good.
He's a smart... Every time he's in a scene, let's call them scenes, every time he's in a scene, you're just like, oh, it's all right, Taivar's here.
But, like, he is fucking Kaito.
Yeah, he is, yeah. And that's the thing,
and
I guess...
it's really cool how they kept that.
And I think it's also really cool that everyone's like, why is he here? And then they really grounded this idea of, like, the idea that he's so, like, abhorrent of the Realmbreaker because it's a twist on the World Tree, you know? Yeah. And every time anyone mentions the World Tree, he goes, you know, it's like, it's not the World Tree, it's their World Tree. And it's not, he doesn't even like calling it that, you know? Yeah. He calls it a bastard. He doesn't use the word bastardization, obviously. He used the word perversion or something at one point. But it's also interesting that these are two black-aligned characters.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
And they're
Kaito's blue-black,
going it alone. And you have this feeling. And what's really great is you have it against the moment where they square off against Tybalt and Ajani. You know, for all of the writing fantasy, action is blah, 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 whatever. You're like, I feel like my eyes fade as I try and look down for the next bit of dialogue, because that's the bit that's more interesting. It's like, oh, they clash, bang, wallop, great, cool, fantastic. Things happen, stuff and things. But the two of them being able to be this united front of... Mm. I guess it's in the face of an oppressive white antagonist, right?
Yeah.
Because Norn is still... Because as much as we say, like, within the story, we see all of these resistances. There's a massive talk about how Sholdred still fights against her, how Urabrask is having this resistance. But there are still cards where there are images, and we'll get probably to this in when we get to the Flavor Picks episode, of where Norn's like got like a decree, and she's talking to all of the other praetors, and they're all like, you know, showing subservience to her, apart from Urabrask, who is obviously, you know, in his own furnace layer. Like, so as much as that's kind of at odds sometimes, you are fighting Norn and her plane. You know, she is the closest, the Fair Basilica is the closest to the Mycosynth, is the closest to the Seed Core. Being the closest to the Mycosynth means it, it was the most infused and the most readily infused as it spreads outwards, you know? Like, I think the fact that the Furnace Layer is the most outer, the outermost layer, the most close to Mirex, being like the ex-Mirren, they didn't come up with a very good name for it, the ex-Mirren layer, I think is really telling. And then it goes down towards the surgical. Hunter's Maze.
Hunter's Maze, then Hunter's Surgical.
Then Surgical Bay, then Shuldred. Because Shuldred, as much as the Thanes and everything and being in battle with each other and, you know, being at odds against Elesh Norn, I feel like the Black Aligned Phyrexians are still very close to True Phyrexia, because True Phyrexia was a Black Aligned, you know, plane anyway.
Yeah, they're Yawgmoth.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. And even then, the infighting, the ambition, this all plays towards, like, this idea of all will be one. That is the true message of of New Phyrexia, and it makes sense from a Phyrexian point of view, but that wasn't really the true... As much as Yawgmoth created the Glistening Oil and it does take over and homogenize everything, this idea of making everything under one banner wasn't necessarily, like, his true message. It was more conquering and wanting to win, you know? He had his own personal ambition, whereas Elesh Norn always has this... Always feels like, everything's fine.
Well, yeah, it's that unifying thing. It's that kind of classic spin on the white,
like, you don't understand the perfection, you know? Yeah. And I think there was even a point early in the development of Elesh Norn's character of where even it was said that even she didn't believe in her own orthodoxy. But I think now that's kind of been canoned out, because I feel like it kind of undermines...
Yeah, it doesn't
It doesn't work, so you know, it doesn't work, exactly.
Just to cap off the Tyvar Kaito sort of colour theory thing, is that I think you said it there, the black-aligned Thanes are ambitious. Mm. And we forget, we sometimes think, obviously classic, our first five episodes we're talking about this, really. But, like, you know, a lot of people assume that if they're black, they have to be selfish and evil. Whereas also, that's true of black, but black can also be... ambitious, and also gambling. I know the card gamble is technically a red card, and the idea mechanically of kind of not knowing what the outcome is going to be is very red.
So Tavern Swindler is a black
card. Tavern Swindler is black card. Mm. Black is also the other gambling
colour. Take the risk.
It's taking a risk.
Yeah.
And if there's anything about swashbucklers and adventurers and the characters of Kaito and Tyvar that we've seen in their own arcs, it's that they both dive in sword first, ask questions later.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's absolutely a black move. Like, yeah, cool. Like, they're going to go, yeah, I'm going to put myself at risk and, like, my life total, if you like, if it means the rewards are going to be great.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so, yeah, absolutely, they're great.
And I think it's also... I think it's interesting that I feel like as a strike force... I mean, apparently there were two strike forces. Again, this is one thing that would be nice to know in the plans, would be like, you know, we plan to go with these five on this team and this five on this team. But they clearly had, like, a balance of colour as well, you know, like... You need the ones that are more grand. I mean, Kaya as well is like a massive figurehead within this story arc. You know, like, she's the backup to Jace. If everything goes to shit with Jace, she's the one who's going to detonate the Silex. She's the only other one who knows how to.
And she's white black.
And it's funny that the two of them, the two, Kaito and Kaya, right at the end, were trying to fight against Jace doing this, blowy uppy the everything, you know. And again, whether...
Is that the selfishness?
Well, that's
through?
The thing is, the question is, for I think for Kaya, because she's specifically white black, she's the only person I feel like you can go... She has the most measured responses, because she won't think purely from a whole, this is the best thing to do, and ignore, like, actual reality. But then she's also willing to question her own, you know, her own specific ideas for the greater good. Yeah. You know, I feel like she's the perfect character to kind of question that morality. She did a really good job of balancing out the Orzhov, for example, working with Taser, you know, like releasing all of the ghosts and all of the fucking contract and pledges and stuff from that arc. Like, she's very good at trying to create this fairness, you know. I think all she wants to do is right the wrongs of the multiverse, and the fact that they were trying to fight against this logic, and whether or not that logic was compromised by this point, I don't think we'll ever really know. Or maybe we will, who knows. We haven't yet, big bugbear, have got a Phyrexian perspective. We haven't got a Phyrexian point of view yet in this story.
Not
really.
In the main stories.
Not in the main stories. We haven't seen what Elesh is thinking. We haven't seen the moment that Urabras goes, this is the time to fight back, you know. We haven't seen... We've kind of just seen it, like, exteriorly, because it's all been a focus on the Planeswalkers. And it's curious to me that in a setting where we've said for years that we don't like it when sets are only based around Planeswalkers and their interactions, they've balanced it enough with the denizens of Mirrodin, with the Mirrens themselves, and then also not made these Planeswalkers feel like just stand-in, stompy, I'm going to do what I want kind of people.
Yeah, they've been really good.
And it's a shame that Kaito and Kaya could be questioned for, like, this was your chance to destroy Phyrexia.
Yeah.
But then there was also a question mark, because you could always say there is no cost too great for destroying Phyrexia. but somehow they created a circumstance of where there was a cost too great.
Yeah.
And I wish there was a little bit more visual aid for how the Realmbreaker is invading the other planes. I feel like it's the only thing you don't really see.
Well, it's they did this on Kaldheim too. They give very beautiful descriptions that mean very little.
Exactly, because I'm like, that doesn't make sense in my head. How are they in the middle of nine spheres sort of that you can see into the multiverse?
And shit.
Yeah. You kind of got to give like artistic license to the writer a lot of being like, okay, right, tell me what I'm seeing. Cool, I guess I believe it. So, I mean, yeah, it's just interesting to see that a lot of the leads in this arc and a lot of the voices for good, so to speak, quote unquote, are the black aligned characters.
Yeah. We'll move on to the side stories, I think, and then we can do a bit of a wrap up. There's one line which I really liked. I mean, Sean McGuire's writing is really good, but one of my picks for best line of the series, and it's where they were showing deference to Nahiri. They were equally having the new crop of planeswalkers kind of wondering what the fuck Jace is about and why everyone's giving him such like deference. It's Jace basically taking the Mirrens into the arena to save Vraska, which they all unanimously agree is a dumb
bad idea,
but they're all gonna fucking do it anyway because
we don't split up. You know.
And then Kaito comes in with, "This is a terrible idea," muttered Kaito. "I have plenty of terrible ideas, but they don't usually get everybody around me dead. But Jace has special bad ideas, I guess."
Right?
It's like, yeah. And basically that was, I don't know if this is what McGuire was intending or whatever else, but that is a massive community foghorn of going, Jace is a moron sometimes, and yet he never gets called out on it, really. Yeah. And like, look, we all love Jace. I know we bargain him and stuff, but actually there's a reason why he's one of the dual faces of the game. He's a very interesting, very nuanced character, but he's a fucking moron sometimes, and people don't really call him out on
it. Yeah, I feel like his fallibility is a thing that makes him likable, so no one wants to call him out, because they don't want him to lose that fallibility. When he was like a goody-two-shoes, everything's great kind of person, no one liked him. As soon as he got to Ixalan and started showing like these very human faults and actual, like, you know, human progression, and we found out a lot of it comes down to the fact his, you know, brain was all fudged up by himself, you know, like it makes him more amenable, you know, it makes him more likable, and it's nice to see that kind of come full circle with other characters going like, this guy's a fucking tool, and it's like, yeah, but we love him.
All right, cool. We'll do some wrap up between the two sets of stories, but let's move on to the side stories now. So we have, let's just kick off, we'll do one by one. So let's kick off with Nathan's getting another drink.
Yeah, drink. Yeah, we have to kick off with another drink. You're not having another one?
Oh, yeah, I'll go and grab my beer.
There we go. This is a nice interval. This is good.
You're going to have to scooch through.
That's fine. I'm scooching.
Oh. I might ask you to throw another log on the fire as well.
Yeah, that's fine by me. I like firing logs.
Okay.
Tell me.
Right, there is a bag of logs there.
Yep.
Just grab one.
Yep.
What you're going to do is you're going to use the cloth that's underneath the last step.
Yep.
You're going to use that to open up the thing.
Yep.
And you're just going to bung that straight on top.
Okay.
And you're going to close that.
Yep.
There you go.
Beautiful.
And then we're just going to leave it.
Easy. Fire makes fire.
Fire makes fire. We're back in my boat, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, the plan was to try and get down to the LGS and try and do it in person there, you know, and have games and stuff wrapped around it. But, I mean, this is actually quite nice. It's cosy.
I'm keeping this all in.
Yeah.
I'll jump out of the covers. This is all
staying lovely,
here.
Amazing.
All right. So we have, for the side stories, 5 side stories. All of them are very, very different. They have, you know, as people have read the side stories before, sometimes they might, like, bunch a couple together or whatever else. These are all completely separated from each other. And we're going to do one by one. First one is Cinders by Cassandra Kaur. Cassandra Kaur did the Unbowed trilogy, which introduced us to Vivian Reid. So,
right,
So they're returning to Magic. These are the only 4 stories they've ever done. As a very brief overview for Cinders, we follow a Mirren Resistance cell as one of their leaders tracks their best friend who has run away from their Resistance cell to basically find their mother who has been Phyrexianized, and it's showing the sort of horrors of everyday Mirrens fighting the Phyrexians and the kind of in the trenches soldiers.
Yeah, it's more low to the ground.
Very low to the ground.
Yeah.
It's
fine.
It's okay.
So as we said before we started recording, I feel there's a certain, as much as wizards for some reason, and they seem to do this thing of like, you're only going to be able to relate to humans. As soon as a story is kind of based around humans, my brain immediately goes, well, I see enough humans day to day. Time to switch off my brain and ignore everything else, because I don't want to go into my fantasy setting and see humans. like the whole point, and that we didn't mention this, like there's a statement from Koth about how there are less and less elves each. There's less and less elves. There are barely any elves left on Mirrodin. He hasn't seen an uncompleted Vedalken in years. It's like, great, so we're stuck with the spiky rock humans. It's like, I guess, again, it's relatable. The way that they interact with, like, the way they consider their family and that kind of thing is a lot more relatable. But it just makes the story seem a little bit more yada yada. Yeah, sure, okay. Because there's enough, like, war and stuff in the real world that you got to really push the fantasy element for me not to be like, cool, yeah, war's bad, I get that.
Mm.
You know? And again, like, it's fine. And there were moments of where, of her realizing that, you know, she kills this random Phyrexian that seems to be hurting her friend, and then she finds out from her friend the reason why she wasn't fighting back was like, that was my mother, and you kind of have that like moment of like, oh
yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Like that hits home.
Yeah, so you have Niali, who's the leader of the Mirren cell, and her best friend Rihanna, and one's a Volshock, one's a Ishock.
Oriok. Yes.
Volshock and Oriok, there you go. Yeah. So it's kind of showing all the Mirrens collectively coming together, and you have like other races of Mirrodin that are still around. They're kind of clubbing together. We do have an appearance of Slobad, who's the kind of villain of the piece, and we see Slobad, who's, I mean, it's Khan Silver Golem's body, right?
That's the thing. The Bosch.
Bosch.
The
thing, sorry, Bosch.
So the way we're looking at it is, yeah, we're combining Bosch's body with Slobad's torso, and you can even see, it's even mentioned specifically, you can see where the flesh ends and the metal connects.
Mm.
And it's very much a fusion of the two of them, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a nice description of the pauldron of one of his arms has other Mirrodin goblins like kind of cast into
them. The heads of Mirror, and if you see in his artwork and you zoom in, you're like, oh, you hadn't noticed that, and it does look really, really cool.
My problem with this story, and it's not the writing, it very rarely is the writing, and when it is, I call it out specifically line for line, and there's nothing in the writing itself that I can have a go at, so I think, you know, nothing, no shade against Cassandra Corr, I think they got dealt a bit of a sort of dud hand with the kinds of stories they want to tell, because this story has a lot about the kind of horrors of Phyrexia, the kind of the idea that maybe one of the Mirrens is going to willingly become an aspirant of Phyrexia is an interesting idea.
That's a very cool idea.
And just all of this kind of stuff. There's lots of nice little ideas, but essentially what we're looking at is a redux version of the main story where a group of people go to attack some Phyrexians, and you're just like,
and it doesn't go very well.
And it doesn't go well.
Shocking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there we go. That's Cinders.
It is cool to see talk of the Mordroth Phoenixes, to be fair.
Oh, that's true.
There is a little bit of that. And they're talking about how like they're hatching, and it's nice to see the two. Like, again, Low to the Ground is fine when you're in downtime.
We love Low to the Ground.
Low to the Ground is really cool in between the arcs. But when you've got this big sweeping planeswalker invasion of New Phyrexia, Low to the Ground stories are like, cool, I don't care. I want to be flying. So don't give me Low to the Ground stuff when there's all this cool stuff up in the air.
Yeah, yeah, I sort of feel as well that there wasn't enough. Like, I don't think the story. I mean, how do I phrase this? I think a lot of people have been really looking forward to the return of the Mirrens, and because we kind of presumed that a lot of them had died, like that they were kind of extinct, and then there was that Wayne Reynolds artwork for Blightsteel Colossus that showed that Mirrens were still around because he was fighting a bunch of Volshocks in the artworks. So that kind of kickstarted a lot of like, ooh, but I think the tantalizing nature of that was more that New Phyrexia hasn't been completely lost. I don't know how many people really cared when there's all this other stuff going on about the actual Mirrens themselves, which is weird.
It's similar to kind of like, Innistrad is always going to have, well, even once everything's blown over, you're going to still have all of the horrors and everything. I feel like with Mirrodin, it's gone. Like, it should, as much as I don't want to say it should, and I don't really want to, I don't necessarily want to see a set in the future of where we go back to Mirrodin, where it's kind of recovering from the Phyrexianization. We've already had that with Zendikar, we already have that with Innistrad every time we go back there. I feel like, as much as the Mirrens and their resistance is a cool idea, I feel like it's something that, in reality, from my point of view, you can't narratively justify them surviving if Phyrexia succeeds to then have its full invasion. I feel like at that point, you know, Mirrodin is lost. It is now New Phyrexia.
Yeah. Moving on then. We have, in the next story, we have A Hollow Body by Ayusha Ufara. Ayusha Ufara. I think I made this exact mistake last time we spoke about them. And last time we spoke about Ayusha was with A Cry of Magic.
Oh, yeah.
Another story spotlight. Fan Again, favorite. This is a who's who. Fan favourite for us, as well. Which was Ruther's individual story from the Strixhaven stories. And a set of stories where, the side stories where, infinitely more interesting than the main narrative. So yeah, and they also did The Edge of the World, which was one of the Crimson Vow side stories with the detective. A little less interesting, but
yeah,
still
that was
good.
The Jacob, right? The Jacob
yeah,
story.
Yeah, that's him. Yeah. And in this one, now we have a difference of opinion. I'm going to give the little synopsis, but prior to talking about this, we have a difference of opinion about this episode, I think. Basically, we are seeing this is through the eyes of a Phyrexian.
Holy shit! It happened.
It happened immediately, as you said. Like, oh, it never happens. It happened. What is their name? Ixel. And it's Atraxa. So if Elish Noren creates Atraxa, who is the four-colour Phyrexian angel, four-colour because Urbrask didn't partake in building Atraxa. Atraxa has now made something in their own image. This is another Phyrexian angel, but like a third generation of Phyrexians now underneath Elish Noren's kind of rule, called Ixel. And it is a mission where Atraxa and Elish Noren task Ixel with finding and killing Geth, who is now
Thane of Contracts.
The way that the Black Aligned Phyrexians organize themselves is that whilst Sheldred was a praetor, that was like because they were the current sort of more dominant Black Phyrexian leader. The Black Sphere has a bunch of Thanes. I think, what was it, seven in total? Seven still Thanes that were all trying to vie for dominance, very much because they are all ambitious motherfuckers. So, yeah, there was never, like, it's not like how Vorinclex and Jinkataxis and Urabrask dominated their spheres. The Thanes were constantly fighting each other. And we see through this story, Ixel sort of having a crisis of identity.
I want to say faith as well. Like faith, I don't, the orthodoxy is the orthodoxy. It's not a religion, it's a way of thinking, but it turns out that way of thinking is only a way of thinking, not the way of thinking.
Yeah, so what we see is Ixel sort of having what they would, I guess, consider being impure thoughts, which I suppose to us is kind of... We would understand them as they're having, like, a non-Phyrexian... I'm going to say human, but by human I mean, like, just sentient beings that aren't Phyrexians. It's just, you know, we would say it's a human emotion in a very Star Trek-y kind of way. And they are both completely devoted to the will of Phyrexia, but they don't quite understand the emotions they're having. And these emotions get pulled at and teased at by a lot of the Phyrexians on the Black Sphere level, including Geth. At the end of the story, we see Ixel trying to have their own creation where they've made a new Phyrexian out of the decapitated head of Geth and a new Phyrexian body, something which Elish Noren and Atraxa see as an abomination. If my synopsis of this sounds like weird and bizarre, this story is fucking strange.
It is what? Wait, so it's in the second person, which you very rarely get stories in the second person anyway. It creates this really... This is exactly why I want more Phyrexian point of view. Because it's very... Again, like, it's interesting because you're seeing a new way of thinking, a new way of expressing. You get to understand the Phyrexians when otherwise all you're supposed to go is, oh, God, crazy, scary, no.
Yeah.
And instead you get to understand a little bit of the hypocrisy of Phyrexia. Because this is the thing that I think that will ultimately be its downfall, is the hypocrisy of itself of... Why is Elish allowed to create Atraxa and then Atraxa are able to create Ixel when Ixel's not able to create... I can't remember what the name of it is. Now, we know what the name of it is because of the... it's not on the artwork. I've already scrolled down to it. I don't think it gives it...
Vishgraz.
Oh, that's it. Vishgraz. And like we've got that card within the Commander set as well. And we haven't mentioned, but these are the two stories that follow the two Commander sets in the same way that the Lopez story followed the Akiri story, and we got one for AC or whatever it was, this the Dire Straits or whatever. We got the two different
in Zendikar Rising. We got like Ubosh and all that.
So then we get the two stories for the two Commander decks here as well. And I guess Boris is more boring kind of combination, which is why the story was more boring. But this is the Abzan side, right? And I think it's just interesting to see that Atrax is allowed to create Ixel and give them, you know, purpose. But Ixel's creation is known as an abomination. I think all she says specifically is, oh, get rid of it. And clearly Ixel doesn't. And clearly Ixel has a little bit of a push against it. And it also shows that Atraxa has more, like, again, words, human emotions and a human response to it of why would they have an issue. I think the only issue they have is they don't like this idea of their creation. Similar, I guess, to what Alien and Prometheus, of where
the offense... I had no idea you were going to pull that out.
The offense of your creation creating a creation. You know, the idea of God created humans, humans created AI, and then David creates his own, creates the aliens. It's like, why am I not allowed to do what you've done to me? Because they misunderstand the process. And this is where...
Yeah.
And this is what makes Phyrexia interesting, and this is why I really hope we get into the nitty-gritty of it and kind of see itself... Because this is what I see happening, is I see Phyrexia pulling itself apart. Now the Silex Blast didn't work. Now you can't do the detonate the bomb, cut the head off, you know, and everything else dies. I think the only way this can go is for it to slowly pull itself apart based on its own structure, because it shows that maybe Phyrexia shouldn't be a five-colour system. There's a reason why Yawgmoth's Phyrexia was much better, is it? Because it's attracts to the Unifier, and you're missing one of the colours of magic.
Yeah.
So it's almost a betrayal of that understanding of, like, everything falls into line. You know, and you can see this from the fact that the Black Praetors revolt, and the fact that Urabrask is revolting, and even within this story we see a little bit of discordance between them.
Yeah, so Ixelle, by the end of the story, kind of has a self-described... what was it? Dissent? Dissidence? Mm. I've entered that sentence without knowing. Defiance. Your machine orthodoxy means as much as my contracts. This is Fishgraz talking to Ixelle. You aren't him, you growl. Then what am I? You stare at the fractured ground. You're my first defiance.
First.
Now go. So this is Ixelle discovering... that, I mean, whether they're against Phyrexia or not, they understand that they're not part of the orthodoxy, really. And it's interesting what you said earlier about the spheres. The further out from the Micosynth you go, the more kind of rebellious the layers seem to get. We see it here as well, with Elesh Norn is the orthodoxy. Atraxa is their devoted weapon. The weapon of the weapon is now starting to have, like, you know, non-Phyrexian feelings and whatever else that they don't quite understand. Are they then going to start perpetrating these anti-Phyrexians? And it's, you know, I thought it was really strange, and again, just the whole existence of Ixelle as a character in Magic is really odd, where Atraxa is so recognisable as being the Phyrexian angel, that when I saw the Commander product and there was this new face card, I was like, oh, they've got a new Atraxa.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not Atraxa.
No, she's still making idols within her own image.
Yeah.
It's also interesting to see that the rebellious character is missing blue and red, which may be the two colours of... I guess black you could argue as well as being a rebellious colour, but the fact that red being the colour of, you know, of self-preservation, of self-identity, and maybe blue being the colour of, like, conscious, like, intelligence, right? And theory crafting and the idea of progress. Like, the fact that two of those are the ones that are missing within a character that is showing personal identity and showing progress beyond the orthodoxy. Like, the very end is like, deep in the center of you is an ache that wishes to follow him, but you don't.
Not yet.
And that's the line at the end. And this is, I think, one of these things of, like, what we really loved about the writing style as well. It's like, you've got to finish on a little clip, you know, you've got to finish on that kind of that feeling of, like, oh, and it sets the, even if we never get another perspective of this, we already know kind of what the tangent of that shows and what it might mean for the future. And that's what I kind of like from this story. And it's true, I think, at the beginning I said, like, the side stories aren't that necessarily important. I guess we're also going to see this in the next one that we talk about as well. Maybe not the next one, but the one after that. That we do get to see a little bit of the perspective of the Phyrexians, and it kind of, I guess, it might have undermined how aggressive and how dangerous they are if we started to see these fallacies now.
Yeah. I think it's a slow burn. And, you know, we have to, as much as there have been times in Magic Story where it's actually kind of nice to have a break from the breakneck speed of the main narrative, because it's just, it feels rushed and whatever else, and we've said this for different story arcs in the past, the side stories, the low to the ground ones, where we need to be. I think these ones being much more understated, and again, fucking weird, but like weird in a kind of like, they're really trying something with this style of narrative, and then having like the real action in the main stories, I think works real well. I mean, I do like this story, as like reading it, I liked it. There were some character voices where I wasn't sure I was fully on board with. Geth and Balaxis, just their voice.
Balaxis was a bit odd.
It was a bit odd, but in general, really, really loved it.
Yeah.
Moving on, we have...
Also, can someone tell Geth quickly that the Mohawk went out of fashion in the 80s?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the artwork either. But we have Hard as Anger, Bright as Joy by Langley Hyde. Hard as Anger, Bright as Joy. And Langley Hyde, we know from pretty recent Magic history, as doing the main story arc for Dominaria United. Ooh, baby, talk about being handed damp squibs with and duds with their stories. They got handed way too much to do. But yes, did attempt to bring all that together. And I think, I can't remember what we said at the time. I can't remember if I was unkind to them by saying that it was partly their writing that scuppered Dominaria. That doesn't sound like me. I feel like they were given way too much.
I do. I think there was also moments of brilliance and then moments of, like, there was nothing else they could do. The fact they had to jump about the entire plane and create this, create an invasion and a resistance within five stories, and then also do an Among Us episode in the middle of all of that.
Oh, that was my favourite one. That's really good.
Like, that's the thing. The Locked Tower was phenomenal. The build-up to the invasion was great, but the build-up should have been another four fucking episodes. It should have just been build-up. Well, it should have been episode one. We know the invasion is happening because Khan's seen it, but oh, by the way, now it's been several months.
Yeah.
So we don't need to do the build-up.
Anyway, we're not talking about that one anyway. Heart of Anger, Brightest Joy follows, I guess, the other strike team, or at least the remnants of the planeswalkers that form another strike team, in Nissa and Luca going through the Hunter's Maze. So in the main story, one of the first things they do once they get to the facade layer is they basically burrow straight down into the furnace, and they go to the furnace, then straight into the Dross pits.
Yeah.
And they even make a point of saying this circumnavigates the Hunter's Maze and the surgical pit.
Bay. Yeah.
And in true main story, side story fashion, or at least is what they should do, because they don't always, and it's always a shame when they don't, we get the other two layers in the side stories.
In the side stories.
So here's the Hunter's Maze. And we have Luca and Nissa. Very simple story. Real simple story. They are... Ooh, helicopter going overhead. They'll never find us in this boat. we have Luca and Nissa basically just trying to get out of that layer. They know that they're not meant to be there. They're trying desperately to get to the others. It's all from Luca's perspective. And we get like a really weird sort of like buddy cop thing between Luca, Nissa,
a little bit of the Wanderer.
The Wanderer does pop in and pop out again. It was
shocking.
Nice. Yeah. They did a thing where obviously we saw the Wanderer on like a random card in a couple of sets. I really wish they can, like,
they just need to keep doing that. Yeah, we didn't get enough of that over the last like decade of Magic of being like, who the hell is this weirdo with the hat?
Yeah,
we should have just had it more often.
Yeah, we'll talk about the Wanderer maybe more at the end of the story, because I they've achieved something with the Wanderer and I want to talk about it a little bit. I don't want this episode to run too long. So the whole crux of this, the whole point of this story episode, is showing, like what we said about the main stories, where Phyrexia is such on a razor's edge between being this beautiful thing and this horrible thing, showing, I think, not the end of Luca's story arc, but definitely... So again, we're going to disagree, because you weren't too convinced that the Ixelles story was necessarily relevant. And then before we started recording, you were like, why do we need to see Luca being an arsehole? We know he's an arsehole. I don't want to put words in your mouth, you can defend yourself. But my whole thing is actually, this story is perfect at showing Luca as being absolutely the man that he is. He's a sense of duty. He knows, he doesn't like Nissa, but he gets on with her because he knows it's part of the plan.
His regrettable duty.
Yeah. And all the way through, because he makes the fucking dumb decision, because he's got hubris, and because he's bullheaded, and because he's Luca, and he does...
And he's alone as well, considering this. There's no council going to him for this.
He uses the Eluder to join with a Phyrexian creature, this centaur they keep describing it as.
Yeah, we see the centaur in one of the cards in the set, and this centaur looks freaky.
And at one point in their journey, so it's him riding the centaur, Nissa's on the back of him because they meet up, they need to get out of the lair, so they're climbing up this tree. There's a point where they're about to fall off, and he, using the Eluder, tells the centaur to bind him to him.
Secure him.
And in a true Phyrexian way, he goes, yeah, sure thing, boss, and he spikes him with a bunch of tendrils.
Right
through the body, and now they're one. And... fucking of course.
Shocking.
And Nissa the whole time is like, oh, this dude is like connected to a Phyrexian, this isn't gonna go well, but he keeps being like, no, I'm fine,
everything's okay,
and her not really having time to doubt him just goes, yeah, whatever, and it happens exactly how you expect it to happen. Why am I always the Luca apologist?
Do you know what's funny, right, is that the only thing that annoyed me is, why did it need to be, and I said this at the beginning, it's like, why they had to do this, like, five main stories, five side stories, like, I don't understand why they have to stick to this structure, because I feel like this structure is the thing that's damning, this is the thing that hurt Dominaria United, and this is the thing that ultimately hurt a little bit of this. I don't see why this story couldn't have been one of the six. Like, I guess it's a side story, it's not necessarily integrating with the others. The only thing we really see of it, because we didn't read synopsis, is that they're going through the tangle, and eventually, because of his slow Phyrexian influence, and I agree, the way they showed his way of thinking slowly drift towards the Phyrexian way of thinking is, like, it's super sneaky. Phyrexia ain't, like, you believe our thing now, or we taught you. They go, no, we'll just slowly convert your way of thinking to be the way of thinking of Phyrexian. Like, there's different ways of thinking Phyrexian. And it makes sense. And the way it did it, and the way it showed the slow turn, it didn't at any point feel like it was Luca doing the thing that he shouldn't be doing. I guess it's just annoying to me that Luca constantly finds himself in a position of where he can't redeem himself. So maybe we might get a redemption arc in the future. I just feel like it's kind of harsh that he keeps being dealt these really horrible hands of where there's no winning way out of
it. Yeah, I mean, he is the tragic villain. And I know, look, we've said it 100 times. We have to mention it every time we talk about Luca. And we did when we spoke about Okoria. I spent way too much time dancing on the knife's edge for being an apologist for toxic masculinity versus like an interesting insight into how damaged like some male psyches are. Whatever. Like, we understand Luca is the sort of projection of not only toxic masculinity, but kind of a sense of duty over a sense of morality and all that kind of stuff. But there is a line, and it's in like one of the first instances of the whatchacallit, the story, where he says Luca had been expecting, when the telepath, Jace, had tracked him down, Luca had been expecting an attack because of what he had done on Okoria and Annex Strixhaven. So immediately he understands...
He's an apologist.
...that he, like, not that he's done wrong, but he gets that he's not, like... Not everyone agrees with him.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? He's not just thinking, hey, my way's right and wrong, whatever.
He's not delusional about
what
he's
done. about his own, like, where his place, right? Luca had been reluctant initially, but when Jace had told him Phyrexia threatened Okoria, he couldn't stand by. He cared too much about his home for that. Now, toxic, yes. Megalomaniacal.
Yep, good.
Yes. like, through the sundered bond. No one at the end is rooting for Luca.
No.
But we... Or at least I, because maybe I'm a fucking toxic masculinist, if that's a word, saw how he got there and goes, he's doing this because he thinks he's doing right by the plane. Yeah.
I don't even blame him for Strixhaven, because like, the way they present it is like, he was a random planeswalker, and we don't know what happened between him walking there and before. And it kind of shows he's like, for a new planeswalker, we don't know about Ravnica, you don't know about Dominaria, you don't know about these like safe... havens that have this diversity and acceptance, and they know about planeswalkers. You go to a random, I mean, even Strixhaven knows about planeswalkers, but he planeswalked to this random part of it, and then immediately gets ostracized, and immediately gets to a plane and goes, well, this place is fucking shit too. You know, and like, of course, like, how do you ever judge who is the good guy and who is the bad guy when you planeswalk to a plane? We know as the reader, because we know what the antagonist and we know what the protagonist and we know which side you should be on is. But as a planeswalker, when you first reach somewhere, you don't know who to believe to be the bad guy or the good guy. Yeah. And again, like, it got to a certain point where you realised what the Auric were doing weren't great. And it's not like Extus exactly like, was the most, like, convincing of people, you know? Like, he ended up getting crushed by his own... He got hoisted by his own petard, shall we say, you know? But we could understand the motivation, understand why he was put in that position. So, yeah, at no point do I feel like Luca is ever... a bastard. I just feel like he's just got the unfortunate happenstance of he always gets written into corners of where he won't be able to win from.
Yeah, there's lots of things in this story when he's bonded to the Phyrexian Centaur of the promises of Phyrexia, which other characters have also had. But when the other characters have it, they always shake them off as being like, oh, this isn't actually what I think, or whatever else. But Luca, coming from a society... Again, listen to our Ikora episode on humans. It's the worst sound quality we've ever done because it was when we were starting to figure out how to do remote recording. But I think I did some good stuff in that episode because I really believed in it. There's a line here. It says, you deserve power. You are strong. Here, strength is rewarded. The weak are culled. Mm. If he's coming from a human society in Dranith on Ikoria, where literally the whole plane is about strength winning out.
Survival.
I know the Bonders are like the squishy, lovely, like, no, we can live in harmony stuff. But he was risen to believe that you have to be strong to fight against the monsters. If something is promised to him, like, ultimate power, he is not wrong for seeking it out.
No, I agree.
In the grand scheme of things, the world
he has lived in has taught him that this is what you prioritise. And that's the other thing that you don't realise. Like, we're not just... bringing a load of different people with their own wants and needs and whatever. We're bringing loads of people's cultures, the way they grew up, what they consider to be a foundational expectation of the world, or an what's acceptable to them in the world, or what their principles are. All of these things are based on the culture you come from. You know, whether or not you prioritize a family, you know, family being the priority, or a work being the thing, like you laboring, you know, like do you stick to your duty, or do you have, or self-preservation, like all of these different things.
Yeah.
And this is like just within, like, you know, the world that we know. You're talking about extreme circumstances of planes, of where you've got to face zombies every day. And like, it's a really hard thing to balance. And I think, yeah, it's very easy to call Luca out for being a twat, because fair enough, he made a dumb mistake. But I don't know which of the planeswalkers, if you look through all of like the different arcs, all of them made mistakes. None of them are infallible. It's just
Harry's in the story.
You know, like
just a bait that Harry
and even within
out.
Even within this story, like, you know, it's very easy to make mistakes in a place like Phyrexia, and they all just kind of got lucky because the narrative required it. He was a very easy fall guy, and I think it's a shame that he just happened to be the fall guy again. But I do understand why they did it, because it is at least consistent from a character point of view.
This is why I think it was good, because this is like, of course he was going to get
Phyrexianized.
And like, that's sort of on him as much as it is Phyrexians being Phyrexian. Like, you look at someone like Vraska, fucking tragic, because there's no way she deserved that. Mm-hmm. Jace as well. For Luca, it's like, of course he was going to, like, there's no way. And I think talking back to my earlier point about Tyvar being the most Kaldheim, like, and being like a real representation of his plane, I think the other three that have always sprung to mind when I've had those thoughts are Nahiri and Nyssa for Zendikar.
Mm-hmm.
They are real fucking Zendikari, and they always show their colours.
Mm.
And Luca.
Yeah.
Luca is a Korya through and through.
Yeah. And it's funny that we did bounce this into Nyssa. And I feel like the point of this story is that Nyssa very much needed to be completed. Again, we haven't seen this, but I reckon we'll get this when we get to March and the Machines.
It's probably a card art, isn't it?
We'll probably see, all will be one. We'll see a retrospective point of view, I think, of Elisha, of how much she needed Nyssa. Because they arrive within... So the whole point, right, of this is that Nyssa thinks that Luca's taken him out and trying to lead them to safety. And because of his Phyrexianized influence, he's then said leading them to the den of Vorinclex, where Vorinclex and Glissa are sparring, you know, having a little tussled, you know, to keep their...
Glissa's in the story
as well. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things that really interesting, because you notice it, because Luca says, oh, I've seen Glissa before. And at that point, you can tell the Phyrexian within him is the one who recognises her, not him himself.
Is that what it is?
Because a lot of people call down and be like, well, how does he know what Glissa looks like? And how does he recognise Glissa? It's like, because he's already turning, you know? Mm. It's the memories within him aren't his own. They're the Phyrexian memories of the centaur
that he's now
bonded with. That's the person who recognises Glissa.
Oh, good spot, yeah.
And it's also interesting as well to see that Nyssa was kind of bodying Vorinclex alone. We kind of forget that Nyssa's, like, really fucking strong. Like, she's not like, oh, I'm a normal elf. Like, she's, like, elf from Zendikar, and they're, like, boss man, you know? They're, like, really, really strong. Like, she's not just really cool with ley lines and elementals and stuff. She's also got a sword that's really strong. She's really strong. And I think it shows, like, when the two of them were fighting, because it was Glissa versus Luca, and then it was Vorinclex versus Nyssa. And obviously Glissa was able to turn around to Luca and be like, but why are we fighting? We're on the same side. And Luca went, oh shit, yeah, you're right. I didn't even realize I was Phyrexian yet. I guess I am now. And then they turn around to Nyssa, and Nyssa looks around at all three of them and goes, ah, tits. Because the whole point is, like, also, it was nice to see Nyssa having faith in someone again. Like, again, it's the circumstance. You can't really avoid it. You're in this horrible, tangled maze. As long as we're judging by what's was said in the story compared to the side stories, she's already been trapped and planeswalked to somewhere else. So I think she was deliberately pushed into the tangle. Or into the Hunter's Maze specifically for the process of being completed for Elishnorn to use. Again, we haven't got all of those pieces in place yet. But I think that's likely that she dropped down with Jace, then got sucked down to the Tangle, happened to meet up with Luca, and Luca then trapped her down into the... It all kind of was contrived-ish. Yeah. But it's good to see, like, this moment of, cool, had we not known this story, yes, Nyssa gets completed off-camera. And technically she gets completed off-camera anyway, because we don't see... We see her still fine at the end of the story, but there's this kind of, like, all three of them are, like, looming towards her, and it's like, well, obviously Nyssa ain't gonna fucking survive this. And the next time we see her is when Elishnorn, you know, parades all of her new anti-gate watch for all of the others to see. So, yeah, I do understand why it wasn't part of the five stories. I feel like it probably could have been and not been weird. And again, I think, yeah, seeing Luca and his point of view, I'd like to see more of it, though maybe at this point now we've kind of lost him, you know? And it's also we haven't really got any other Boris Walkers beyond the stupid space dog from Unfinity.
That's true.
We haven't got any Boris Walkers.
All three
anymore.
Like with that, Ajani, Nahiri, and Luca.
Yeah, all gone. All gone. Why do they think Boris is such a boring colour? Maybe the Wanderer will get really angry about something at some point. Who fucking knows anyway?
Yeah, they can join.
It's fine.
Next up we have a man of parts. written by Reinhard Suarez. Reinhard Suarez, or Reinhard Suarez, I keep saying Reinhard, it's Reinhard, has been in Magic for a while now. Reinhard Suarez did Chains That Bind and The Mentor from Strixhaven side stories, Survivors from the Crimson Vow side stories, and then took the side stories in quotation, but I think we kind of decided it was just was two halves of the same coin. Took the Brothers War side stories, all five of them, in fact, and had a fucking whale of a time doing some really dense battle scenes, which, you know, thankless task, but I think I smashed it.
Wasn't this the same author that did the... It is, right? These are the... Yeah, it's the Ashiok. The letter of love from Ashiok to Elspeth.
Yes, yeah.
Interspersed within the chapter for the dark, yeah. Reinhardt's great.
Yeah, and this, and I'll say as well from Miguel Lopez, who did do the fifth side story of these ones. So one of the really refreshing things for both the main story and the first three side stories, refreshing because I'm a bad reader, was the fact that we'd kind of gone back to the sort of 2,500 word count mark from the 4,000 a story, which Miguel Lopez and Reinhard Suarez kind of adhered to. And then these last two, I was like, I'm not making a dent in this story.
Yeah,
it's these guys.
This story is long. I'm going to preface this by saying... general audience feedback seems to be like, of all of the stories, this was the hardest to get through because Reinhardt just has a certain way of writing that is very dense, very loquacious. Yeah. Like my vernacular is pretty damn good, you know, as an ex-writer myself. Like I know a lot of words, and even with this, I was like getting through. I was like, you can just use four-letter words, Reinhardt, every now and again. You don't have to make it so difficult to penetrate.
I mean, yeah, but I will say for both, and this is a catch-all for both of them, I think you said it at the time as well, and this is why I think, is this a golden age of magic writing? The level of writing, the level of loquaciousness... These are not magic stories. Like, we don't deserve this.
This is what we need the novels made out of. Give me War of the Spark, written by Reinhard Suarez.
Yeah, or Miguel Lopez. Like, yeah.
Give us them. Like, as much as, again, it's not the fault necessarily of the writer, because magic and wizards will say, you need to hit all of these notes and everything. Fine. But at least they'll hit the notes with enough little fluffiness in between that will make you kind of get over it a little bit.
So, Man of Parts follows Tezzeret. We're back to Tezzeret, Tezzy boy. T-boy. Anyway, Tezzeret, and he is finally getting his reward from Elish Norn, which is a dark steel body. This was hinted at in the last set of stories for Brothers War. And this is him approaching Elish Norn to finally collect on his prize. So this is directly after the battle in the side stories, which actually, as you just said, Reinhard Suarez, the dark, did right. So we have Tezzeret holding the limp body of Rona, fresh from that battlefield. And
another person refusing to die.
Refusing to die. They're the real villains of, like, you know, the episodic villains.
Yeah. Steven says it. It's like, we can put them back together again. It's like, let Rona die. Love of God.
And we see more bits of dissent from Tezzeret, because he starts trying to play off the Thanes against Elish Norn, saying it was their fault that the battle went sour, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, we have Elish Norn agreeing finally to give Tezzeret his Darksteel body. Tezzeret wakes up on the surgical bench in the surgical bay under Jinkataxius's watchful eye, in kind of a, you know, like villains comeuppance kind of way, where in the Neon Dynasty stories we saw Tamiyo being dissected under Jinkataxius and Tezzeret's watch. Tezzeret wakes up on the same table, which he notices, but he does indeed get his body. He does get his Darksteel
body.
Which
I'm surprised about. Like, they actually followed through on something. It's nice to see the Phyrexians not just do that thing where they go, we know we told you we were going to give this, but what are you going to do to stop us? Like, it's actually nice to see them follow through.
But the twist is that Jinkataxius, aware somehow that Tezzeret has been working against them as well as working for them, that he's a bit of a double agent, decides that he's going to use Tezzeret as another experiment to turn his Darksteel body into a Blightsteel body to see whether a new Phyrexianized reality chip, nice little nod back, I don't think it'll become too important, I could be proved wrong, but nice little nod back to the MacGuffin of the Kamigawa era, will be able to turn his Darksteel body into a Blightsteel body within a matter of days as opposed to months, as he said. Tezzeret using... there was a lot of this story seems to be not pandering to audience for their knowledge of Esper and Bant and Tezzeret's home.
In general, it's not pandering to anything. You need to accept a lot. Either be very, very, very on the ball or just suspend your disbelief completely, yeah, because it's going in depth on the random little abilities that like someone's clearly read, or Reinhardt's clearly read Test of Metal.
Yeah.
And read that book. Because I think it's considered to be non-canon at this point because it doesn't necessarily overlap properly. But there are some deep cuts in this story. Like Reinhardt knows what they're talking about. They've researched Tezzeret completely and they've pulled from every aspect of his history to make this story work.
Yeah, so we see Tezzeret breaking free of his surgical bonds by sort of mind melding with a suspended goblin engineer that then he uses as a sort of a temporary body to get off the surgical bench. Mm. He planeswalks away to Esper, his home plane. We see his backstory. We get in sort of things about his childhood.
His father as well.
His abusive father, mm-hmm, his mother who died, the fact he grew up as a street urchin. He takes in a street urchin who was part of a gang who tries to rob him as soon as he gets back onto Esper. And we also see, this is where we start really seeing the idea that the Phyrexian invasion is now just fucking happening.
Yeah.
As soon as he gets to Esper, the Phyrexians are like 2 seconds behind him. So this is obviously happening just as the world, as Realmbreak has been sort of set loose.
Yeah. I guess what would happen is that we're seeing the beginning is kind of like the beginning of this Tezzeret story is happening at the same time as the invasion of the, I guess it would be a day before. Because obviously the end of Elspeth's fight on Dominaria, and I think it was the day after that they started the plan to invade, he might have been on the surgical table for maybe a day. So at this point, yeah, Realmbreak has just broken
through. It's all just gone through.
And we know, we didn't mention this, but we know from the main story arc, it's not Realmbreak is going through and then they've got the invasion. No, they've got like full-on ships loaded with hundreds, if not thousands of Phyrexians already, almost like as these automatic kind of like Realmbreaker platforms are going into planes. Yeah. They're kind of arriving with invasion parties ready to go.
Yeah, they're all good to go.
There's a reason why we didn't mention, they meet very little resistance going through all the different spheres to get down to the bottom, to the point of where it almost seems like a fucking fallacy and the fact that we needed to kind of suspend our disbelief. It was like, no, there are no people here because they're all ready to invade because the invasion's already happened. You've already failed. You're not going to stop
it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
We see Tezzeret taking that young child from the gang that tries to rob him, giving him some Aetherium metal that he puts an inscription into and tells him to send it off to Bant because obviously this is Alara, so yeah, you're
now
shards.
The convergence has now happened.
Yeah, so he's taking him off to Bant to give it to General Rafik.
He's so still Rafik fucking around, many, still double striking.
And then Tezzeret says that he tell him this is a ally of Elsbeth Terrell's. This story again being so dense, we'd have to have a whole episode itself to dissect it bit by bit. But just as assuming you, dear listener, have read this story, has Tezzeret just become the most interesting character in Magic all of a sudden?
Tezzeret, I think, secretly has always been one of the most interesting people and planeswalkers in Magic. He's always played both sides. He was supposed to have died years ago. Nicol has brought him back, not in the same way that Sarkhan Vol had his autonomy compromise and came back. Tezzeret's always been the fool guy.
Yeah.
He's always been after his own freedom, which is a big thing he states here, and he's finally kind of maybe got it. Tezzeret in general, I've never thought as being someone who's uninteresting. Every time he's in a story, there is nuance to him, there are layers to him. You never know where his allegiance lies. It kind of annoyed me when he was in New Capenna, because we didn't really need him to be in New Capenna, because he was just in Neon Dynasty. But it makes sense as being that...
shows that he's playing the other side.
He's playing the other side. Yeah. A double agent, everyone loves Starscream, a double agent is like the best, like, most interesting character you can see, because they get to sit on both sides. They get to see both interactions from... they get to see the agendas, and they get to play the agendas off each other.
Yeah.
If you want... If I'm getting angry, we didn't get enough of the point of view of Phyrexia. The only reason we got this point of view of Phyrexia is because we followed Tezzeret.
Yeah.
You know? So, no, I think Tezzeret has been one of the most interesting characters for a long time. The fact that he was the MacGuffin for the Lazatep army, to be able to, like, the Dreadhorde, to be able to get to Dominaria is one thing, and now he's got rid of the planar bridge. Now he's alone with his Darkstar body, specifically no artwork showing it, which I think is important because we're going to see him in the future. I would love to see in 5-10 years time what Tezzeret's arc was from beginning to end, because I reckon it's probably going to be one of the more interesting stories in Magic.
Yeah, I mean, this story is packed with like tidbits as well. Just the idea of we see that Tezzeret had this thing where he couldn't exact revenge against his mother's killer, so this is obviously like a bitter, twisted thing. The whole idea that he doesn't kill the child, that he takes in from the gang, but he makes his knife better and kind of gives him a fighting chance and gives him the Ethereum note to give to Rafiq. But then when the child tries to thank him, he's like, well, no, I'm not really doing this for you. But he does still save the child and draws parallels between the child and his own upbringing. There's we see lots of different names of different planes that I think have probably been mentioned in other stories.
Big deep cuts, yeah.
Aranzur, Ilkay, Obsidius, Mirankar, Cabralan. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of like interesting things. I love it when they just drop in other plane names.
Because again, it shows that multiversal aspect of it. It's not just the same 10 planes that we know.
Yeah, we have Nashi come back. So at one point, Tezzeret goes back to Kamigawa and gets accosted by a Nozomi biker gang. One of them is Nashi, who's Tamio's adopted Nozomi's son. Mm. If you've never played Magic the Gathering before, these words mean fucking nothing to you. her adopted Nozomi's son. And there's a line. This is what just fucking chilling. I mean, this Suarez is so fucking good. Mm. At the beginning of their like little exchange, Nashi tries to ask Tezzeret if Tamio's still alive. There's a big battle, blah, 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 blah. And about 7,000 words later, Tezzeret has Nashi in his grasp, and it says, Tezzeret nodded. She will come for you soon enough. He leaned in closer. And when she does, you will wish I had killed her. Gently, he placed Nashi's head onto the ground, stood up, and walked away. Mm. Fucking Tezzeret's a badass!
Cool guys don't look at explosions. He's almost like he's a guy who's seen it all. Like, and what I like is, even within this story, you see that kind of carnal fear of survival. Like, he's at the edge of so much bullshit that at this point, how can you not have such, like, amazing reactions to things? Like, he's flawed, but he's still got such, like, he's got, like, panache, but he's still, like, he's a douche at the same time. He's multifaceted as a character, and you could write him into any direction, and it still fit within the character that we know him to be.
Yeah. I mean, going from, we'll have to move on. Read that story. I know it's dense, but you will not regret it. Going from writer for a proclivity. I can't talk now. We've been going for an hour 30 already. For dense storytelling with a super interesting character, we move to Miguel Lopez.
Yay.
With the story Alone. We all know and love Miguel Lopez. Obviously, they did the Mgozi Steps, the Red Root. They did Direction, Purpose, Honor for the side stories from Kaldheim, which is one of the better ones. Did side stories for New Capenna. Did the main stories for the Brothers War. And again, those were like, that was like a novella. Mm. And has now done Phyrexia Orbi-1 Alone, which is like a direct follow-on from the side stories.
Do you think this was all written together?
Yeah, I reckon so.
Because now, the more I look at it, the more I'm like, this is so... I'm pretty sure the end of his story, because the last one that we read, As Cruel As Necessary, was the one where he's talking with Urza, right?
Yeah.
And it's one of what I think we lore to be one of the better stories within all of that, is that the metaphysical interactions of Urza as he's just sparked, having just sparked the or triggered the Silex, and then how Teferi almost had to, like, go into, and it kind of felt a little bit like Interstellar, of where he almost had to go into that 4D space and kind of find the right point in time to go into that moment of time, and that's where he was able to have this kind of like conversation with Urza, where Urza's not going to remember any of it anyway, and then Teferi gets jettisoned into some random beach, which again has similarities to how Kaito started the story of New Phyrexia on a beach. So that's quite a nice bookend. But then it goes directly into being back in that place again. Back in question mark. And it very much, and I said this again before the episode started, and before we started recording, I was like, I just don't understand why you needed to put a bookend from a previous set at the end of the next set, beyond creating this, you know, false suspense of, is it Zalfir? Spoilers, it's fucking Zalfir.
So, we find Teferi on this random beach that we found him on at the end of the previous stories. He is no longer part of the temporal anchor. He's no longer a spirit either, so he sort of feels like he's been sent somewhere else. It was ambiguous as to where he was being sent. Was it out of time? Was it out of space? He is on the displaced, phased out continent of Zalfir.
Yeah.
That has been in a bubble of time. And it seems like, as we go through the story, so he comes across a caravan after wandering around sort of the wastes.
Naked.
Yeah, he wakes up nude. so he's just kind of going through the wastes and on kind of like a week-long pilgrimage. He hooks up with a caravan. The caravan is a group of traders that have the guards. The guards turned out to be bandits that killed the guards and took their place. So kind of life is just sort of in a turmoil. He instantly gets recognized. So this isn't Zalfir 400 years later. This is Zalfir as he phased it out. But the people of Zalfir are aware that
they're displaced.
They're displaced, and that time has passed. So through the story, he meets up with this caravan. He goes to a local village. He starts working as a fisherman. He gets kind of reinstated back into the religious orders of Zalfir. People recognize him as the Archmage, even when he tries to deny it. People are like, no, 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 we know who you are. No one tries to kill him after the first meeting with the bandits. So it's almost like time has passed for Zalfir, where they understand that he is, like, he's still not loved, he's still not beloved.
He's still the destroyer of Zalfir.
But he is also still the Archmage.
Yeah.
And they understand that there was a Phyrexian war, and it's sort of like, Teferi goes there and sort of starts to realise, he's like, oh, I didn't, like, these people aren't just arrested in their development in terms of their minds, they're just arrested in developments as to their relationship to time, to everywhere else.
Yeah.
And he meets the Queen of Zalfir, and she even goes, 364 years later, and we're still facing this threat. So they are aware.
Yeah, that's the thing that's interesting. I don't know, maybe they, because their amber prisons as well kind of show, and I need to maybe go back and reread, like, old lore, but I don't remember Zalfir being that much, like, more progressive in terms of, like, its military prowess or its magical prowess or whatever. I don't imagine it being, like, it wasn't, like, you know, they accidentally blipped out, like, the industrial, like, best continent of Dominaria, and then went, oh, we've just lost our, you know, our brightest and our most powerful. But it does feel a little bit like they're very self-aware. I think they say 10 years. 10 years has passed for them.
Yes.
And they've been preparing this entire time to fight Phyrexia, which is kind of great, because it kind of vindicates us if we were like, is Teferi just gonna phase back in Zalfir? And Zalfir's like, we're ready to fight you bitches, because they are. They're very much like,
they're ready to fight original Phyrexia.
Yeah, they're like, kind of show is like, show us Phyrexia and we'll show them our axe. You know, they're very, very ready to fight. And I think that's kind of interesting. I just don't understand. For me, the only thing that doesn't make sense with this set is that why, or this story, is why it needs to be placed here, because it doesn't set up a great, like, massive narrative cliffhanger that, oh, that's why they left it to put it here, because now that's going to be relevant to the next bit.
Mm.
Having all of this information, everything that happens within this story, because also Kervex kind of just dropped in at the end.
Yeah, so Kervex gets let loose from his amber prison.
The Wanderer.
Well, this is it. So there are two.
Yeah.
The placing of the story is odd, you're right, because it does sort of seem like it's just the end side story and a bunch of disjointed side stories, where in the last set, they were all the same narrative, they were just put in side story category, la la la. There are two big things that happen here. The first one is that it's another tick on the clock of Teferi's redemption. We're not fully there, but every time we see Teferi, he's one step closer to kind of regaining his space in the multiverse and not having this crushing guilt about maging out Zalfir.
And he quite specifically even says, like, when he's talking with Sabina, like, Sabina kind of, in his mind, for him personally, forgives him, and that for him, in the
Subira, his wife,
in lieu of having Zalfir there to kind of apologize to and forgive him, he kind of almost took a personal forgiveness from that. And then he realized, going to Zalfir, is like, okay, I had no right to consider myself absolved of the guilt just because one person was able to get over it.
Yeah.
You know, I've still got to get the entire continent.
And the more time he mingles with all that, so he's a fisherman in a village for a while and people there know who he is. He meets up with an old general friend of his, he meets up the queen, and at each point they all sort of say to him, look, we know what you did, we can't forgive you per se, but you still have a purpose here. And we need to focus on that. I think his general friend's a bit more merciful. He says, we all know about the penitence in the desert, because he walks for like a week to get back to Zalfir's sort of centre. Yeah. And he's like, look, your transgressions are your transgressions, but we know that you're trying.
Yeah.
So it's finally giving Teferi, now he's confronted with his problems, this idea that even the people who he wronged are like, yeah, you wronged us. There's a problem, we need to solve it. Like, we get why you did it, it was fucked up, but there's a bigger thing than your guilt going on here.
Mm.
And so that's one big thing, is that we get another little notch on the Teferi belt of, like, bringing him back. When he fully brings back Zalfir, and when they eventually come and crush Phyrexia, then we'll have kind of fully absolved Teferi, he can do other things. The next one is the Wanderer, as you said. Well, Zalfir's been phased out.
Mm-hmm.
So the fuck is the Wanderer doing there?
Yeah, how did the Wanderer get off of New Phyrexia, when the consideration of why a lot of people say, oh, why don't we just planeswalk again, since we've planeswalked to the wrong place, is like, well, if we hit interference coming in, can you imagine how much interference we're going to get going out?
Yeah.
And also, Teferi specifically within this story says that he tries to touch his spark and he just felt a numb twitch.
Yeah.
So his Spark isn't working within this phased out. I think I looked at, on the wiki, it's considered to be a pocket plane.
Yeah.
Now, what pocket plane means in terms of metaphysics, we don't fucking know, because they don't tell us anything. Whatever they want it to be. But clearly it shows that he can't planeswalk out, but somehow the Wanderer, I don't want to use the word planeswalk, so it's kind of wrong for her.
She's blipped into it.
And then somehow they manage within moments of her blipping in, because they say that she's kind of almost mid-strike. So it clearly shows that Teferi isn't the only person in Xalfia who knows how to do time magic. They're able to create these amber prisons that clearly lock you in place within your action, because she's still like mid-swing.
Yeah.
But he mentions how her face is changing from anger to confusion. It's almost like she's kind of stuck mid-thing going, well, I'm not attacking anyone anymore. I've now been put in this prison. This is strange. And obviously hasn't blipped back out again. So the amber prison she's been put in overrides the instability of her spark.
Yeah.
But how's she come? How is she here?
So it's either, like, Teferi muses that Xalfia is still connected to the multiverse, and that could still be true. And he kind of says it's bittersweet, because it means, right, Xalfia's not lost. Which was something that he kept sort of saying in the story. It was like, no, I don't think you understand. Like, we're fucked.
Mm.
But it does also mean that if they're still connected to the multiverse, they're still connected to the new Phyrexians.
Yes.
The flip side of that could be that it's the Wanderer herself has her... Because she got a bit of respite when she had the reality chip. But then there's suddenly, like, her spark's starting to go all screwy again.
Super erratic.
Now, is this the thing? Because she's not been part of the action. She just keeps getting, like, a little bit phased out. That her contribution to the Phyrexian war... is that she's going to blip Phyrexia out.
Right, so this is the other thing that's mentioned in one of the stories, is that Kaya... Because I think Nohiri turns to Kaya and goes, oh, maybe you could have talked to her in your phased out state. And then Kaya like has mentions, like, oh, I hadn't really thought of that, but I guess it's entirely possible. Because the Wanderer, whatever happened to the Wanderer upon that interference from Phyrexia, puts her slightly out of sync.
Yeah.
And it's the same out of sync that Kaya can willingly go to the point of where she can flex that around other people and get them to planeswalk.
Yeah.
And it's the same out of sync that Xalfia is, because it's not, you can't planeswalk to it, but it's still within the multiverse but separated from. Do all of these things all layer on top of each other? Is there some, was it a mention of Kaya? And I don't want Kaya just to be the MacGuffin and her magic be able to fix everything, but at least it's interesting because we don't know this, what this phase shifting kind of really does. We don't really know what the point of the Wanderer not having her, because the reality chip could have just fixed it, right? Narratively, could have just fixed her planeswalking spark, could have made it once she got back with Kyodai, they've reconnected, everything's fine again. But clearly they didn't fix it for a reason. Mm. They clearly highlight it right at the beginning for a reason, and now she's here for a reason.
So this is the thing I really liked them doing with the Wanderer, is that now, once the Wanderer got revealed as being the Emperor, and we got a
Emperor?
Card...
Yes. Oh yeah, I guess the Emperor's, gender neutral, fair, carry on.
Well, you can have Empress, but they
no, I think prefer Emperor. No, I prefer gender neutrality.
they... gave her a card art where you saw her face. Whereas all previously, you didn't see her face, and that obviously fed conspiracy theories and whatnot.
So, is she Emrakul? Remember those days?
Yeah. And it was like, we said it time and again, it hasn't actually ruined her character that we've seen her face, and now there are as many card arts of her with the hat as without the hat, or like whatever else. You know, the kind of, the mystery, what they've achieved with her is that the mystery is still there, despite the fact we know exactly who she is and how she works. She's still very enigmatic. Mm. And there's a line here, and I fucking jumped out my seat. I was reading this earlier today, and I was like, what the fuck? That's such good writing. Where it was, this is Teferi asking, his friend Jabari's saying, like, oh, there's another one like you who's here, and Teferi's like trying to muse who it is, and Jabari goes, no, this one is a woman of regal bearing. We have her secured in amber as well, but before we did, Jabari reached out to Teferi again, tapping him on the chest, emphasizing each word. She asked for you. A woman of regal bearing. He knew too many. Could Kaya of Sephelia have devised some way to cross the void of Xalfia? How long have you been outside of this space? And it's like, you know, this description of, like, regal bearing, this, that, and the other. The description goes on to be like, we have this hat and this sword. And you're like, ah, oh, it's the Wanderer! Yeah. Like, you know, and he even says the word, you will come with me, Aku, to see this other Wanderer like you. And, it's
and then Teferi's like, not a Wanderer.
Not the Wanderer.
It's just,
they really achieved this idea of this kind of gunslinger samurai character where we know what they look like, and yet they're still like brim hat down. The other bit of writing, we are running a bit long now. This is the very end section of the story, and this shows just how fucking good Miguel Lopez is. So this is after Teferi's got a plan of action. He knows what's going on. He's kind of lit a fire under his ass to be like, no, I am going to like rectify what I'm going to do. Eshe, who weathered the ages. Ayana, who looked at danger with bravery. Adaya, who longed to build a peaceful future. Subira, whom he had loved and who had loved him. Niambi, whom he had loved and who loved him. Zalfir, with whom he stood, father of the creeds, father of a nation. It's not too late, Teferi said, a fierce grin spreading across his face. The Phyrexians probing through the multiverse had awoken something that their machine minds would learn to fear. Teferi, who would show them that the sun rises in Zalfir.
Oh, God, yeah. That is such good writing.
Yeah. That is such good writing. And especially if you read it from main story through to side stories, like a book, you know, left to right. If that's the last line of Phyrexia will be one that you read, bam, into March Machines. Yeah, like, exactly. Let's go. Like,
that's the thing, right? It's the collision. That we know Phyrexia succeeded in their penetration of the multiverse. I think that's also something that I maybe would have liked to have seen in retrospect more of is... They describe the Realmbreaker succeeding quite well, and they keep alluding to it and talking about it, but it didn't... I would have liked to have seen maybe more of a... There was almost a moment of like, wait, did they just lose? Did the Realmbreaker just make it to the... Oh, yeah, I guess. Because then it says, like, oh, you can see the multiverse. I'm like, oh, I guess it did. I was like, well, that felt a little bit understated. There wasn't... It didn't feel like... That's the thing. The moments of like, oh, shit, are all like the good guy bits. And it kind of annoys me that we didn't get that kind of like, oh shit moment from the Phyrexians.
That's a fair critique.
Because that little Realmbreaker succeeding should have been the end of a story before then the rest of the next story should have been. I guess it did because it fell into the episode 4 before we then went into episode 5 and we catch back up with the Kaito and Tyvar fighting Ajani and Tybalt. But it kind of felt like it was a little understated because this is the kind of aplomb that you want, right? This kind of idea of like, can't wait for next set because Zelfir's going to come back.
There are some times when I read, and again, this is because of me thing, this isn't necessarily a writing thing, where I read stories and side stories and I think, cool, I'm done with reading Magic Story for another 3 months, thank you very much. Fucking this, just give me March Machines now. Now. Where's the story going? Give me.
Like, don't leave Elspeth wandering the Blind Eternities. Don't leave Zelf for fate. Like, give me it now. I want to know the next bit. And that's what you want the story to feel like. You don't want it to be like, cool, yeah, done, close book. I guess we'll pick up this later, you know? And I guess a few sets can feel a little bit like that. And again, maybe this shows the success of the narrative arc and the narrative progression of where we've seen a few sets and where we're like, cool, that was New Capenna, nice, some Urabrask shit, cool. And then Neon Dynasty, oh, fuck, like, they completed Tamiyo, cool, I guess we'll find out who else they've completed next time. Whereas with this, we're like, oh, this is building up to
this
the finale.
This is it, we're full steam. Yeah, loved it. Thought the Planeswalker choices for completion were fine.
Yep. I mean, I'm more interested to see what they do with them now than how they became what they are.
Yeah.
So again, I hope we get a bunch of POV of Phyrexians. I actually really hope we get the POV of the completed walkers and then see them interacting with the Praetors rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
Because as much as the Praetors are interesting, I reckon we got a really cool story from Elspeth and Elish and Ashiok, and it showed a little bit of the interest of Elish Norn, but when you have a one-dimensional Praetor that only has one thing of thinking, like, I'm the smartest, Jinxtaxius, it's like, cool, there's only so much that becomes interesting. Yeah. Infinitely more interesting places the third person rather than the first person.
Tybalt did get squished by Tyvar, but as we've seen with other Phyrexians... They can rebuild them.
Chucked off a bridge, we hear a thud, don't see a body, probably alive.
Ijani's sort of similar vein.
Yeah, like Nahiri drops the entire Phyrexian arena on top of herself and then just showed up fine.
That's true.
So I think Tybalt's probably okay as well. There's no way they don't give us a card for him.
The one last thing before we wrap up I want to talk about is Vraska's Gorgon body. We mentioned it earlier. Now, she is now like the Gorgons are on Theros, which is the very classic... lady torso, snaky hair, but with a snake.
So similar to the Naga from Amonkhet, but not with four arms.
Yeah. Now, she's a Gorgon from Ravnica, where they're more humanoid.
Yep.
And they've played a little bit fast and loose in her card arts with what her hair tendrils do or are. Like, are they hair? Do they have mind of their own?
Yeah.
Whatever.
They've never had faces, at least.
Yeah, exactly. But they've always stuck with, like, no, she's got legs. Mm. So did the Phyrexians look at her and go, you're kind of snaky? Like, did they make that leap themselves? Or do they know about Therosian Gorgons? Like, what's the deal
there? Is there a degree of completion that's, like, dictated by your own... But, I mean, yeah, like, by your own identity and how you'd like to be? Because Jace grew more eyes, right? More ways to see with all these weird little camera tendrils.
Yeah.
And then Luca just directly bonded with an animal and then became... And also, Nahiri's arms turned into swords because her magic is swords. You know? Like, so there's a degree of... Yeah. Is it just playing into what your character in the arc naturally is? Like, one of Nissa grows an extra pair of arms and one of those arms is her staff, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So I feel like there's a degree of it just kind of plays towards what kind of character arc you are. But again, she comes from a plane where the Gorgons don't have tails.
The Gorgons of Ravnica are not snake people.
No, so it's interesting that they've done this because it's like, do they just do it from a whole, well, we might as well take her legs and that's like a big change? Or do they do it because they wanted to make... And also, if you notice, the very end of her tail is the Return to Ravnica set symbol.
Oh, I didn't.
Which is really cute. That's like, cool. That, I mean, again, it's, I don't know. I think it's probably just they wanted to have her be different and there's a chance her legs are still under there somewhere.
Yeah, I just wonder, man. It's just like... I mean, this opens up a whole can of worms even outside of the Phyrexian debate of like... A Leonin is a Leonin is a Leonin. Do you know what I mean? They're a cat person everywhere. Same with, like, you know... I don't
Merfolk
know,
being fish people, Merfolk but not fish.
Merfolk are fish people. Rhinoch, rocks are rhino people. Elephant people are elephant people.
Loxodon.
Loxodon, thank you. Gorgons, sometimes they're snake people.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're
not. Sometimes slithery. Their hairs are snake people. Sometimes
they're not.
It's very interesting. I feel like Gorgon's one of those tribes that they just kind of have to just kind of, like, go, ah, whatever.
Yeah,
like
with
goblins. Sometimes they're monkeys.
Oh, that's true.
You know, so you just gotta...
It's just funny. Anyway,
Yeah, all I know is Spider Kaito in the What Ifs would have been incredible. Let's leave that, because I'd like to talk about the What Ifs when we get to the flavor picks.
Yeah, I think so.
Because there's some interesting things going on there.
Oh, this is a return to our early days when we used to do, like, almost
Chonky,
2 hour episodes.
Yeah.
Okay. Let us know on Twitter, @MTFlavoring, what you think of the stories and where everything's going now. Tell us if you agree or disagree. Nathan and I didn't agree with all everything on this one. We're starting to have more of those disagreements. The podcast may crumble up around us. Let us know on email, mtflavoring@gmail.com. My personal Twitter is @AndyManface. Nathan's is...
@TheFoxAndTheMoon.
Every time I do this, I don't know why I split up the Twitter handles and then put the email in the middle of them. I do podcast Twitter is this, the email's this, our personal Twitters are this.
Interesting. Yeah,
every time I do it and I think about it, and now you'll think about it as well.
Oh, well.
And now you'll think about it, dear listener.
Enjoy.
Cool. I need to pee.
Cool. I mean, there's a canal right next to us, that's fine.
That's illegal.
Oh yeah, of course it is.
Yeah, I have a toilet. It's just like a water pot.
Yeah. Well, this could descend. Anyway, everybody, we have been Magic the Flavouring.
See you
there we go! There we go! We did it!